He was not a writer, not a talker, but he was an activist, whether it was in business or intelligence.
Long before anybody else came up with it, he had this idea of a one world of trading and industrializing countries.
He was a tough little bugger. You were never really conscious of size with Sir William Stevenson. He was a bit like a Jack Russell Terrier. If you know anything about Jack Russells, they all think they're 10 foot tall, and every dog or thing they encounter think they're 10 foot tall too. So it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the amount of fight in the dog.
This is Bristol. It's Friday at 6 o'clock, and welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 8th of April, 2022. Apologies for anybody that was wondering what we were up to. We did actually have a little announcement that was going out for the hour from 5 till 6, but for some reason to do with computer says no, it didn't go out. So anyway, thanks for hanging on with the stream. Yes, we are here. We are streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, relentlessly gaslighting us with military-grade psychological warfare propaganda. And what about the medical misinformation? A bit of that, like an open wound, now apparently forgotten about. Transmitter and printing press owners hell-bent on turning society into a hostile environment for readers, listeners and viewers. Basically, it's a mafia-run society we're living in these days, herding, if they can, tens of millions of innocent, trusting Brits into the metaverse, that is, into Mr. Zuckerberg's loving hands. Instead, navigating us calmly, for the most part, through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and joining us too tonight is Bristol-based cancelled cartoonist, but not cancelled here, Stella Perrett. So, Stella, let's start with you. Can you just tell us a bit, for people that haven't heard you before, how you were cancelled in the first place and why? Because you were actually one of Britain's most important national newspaper radical cartoonists, weren't you?
That's very kind of you to say,
well, you were.
Tony. The Morning Star is quite a small circulation newspaper.
But it's a national paper.
It is a national daily paper, and it's the only national daily communist paper in the UK, which is quite good. And I wouldn't say I was their only editorial cartoonist, but I was their main editorial cartoonist for 5 years, from 2015 to 2020.
I'm biased. Having had a look at some of their cartoons, I think you were the best. So you're actually a very gifted artist. And I suppose politically slanted, you know, as well. So also tonight we'll be talking about the Family Sex Show. This is something that's going to be appearing here in Bristol, apparently, at the Tobacco Factory, if you can believe it. For young people as well as families, come and bring them all along. And also looking at Boris making decisions about transgender sports. He doesn't want transgender men or women or whatever they're called crossing over from one type of sexual orientation, no, not from one orientation, but with women, should be competing with women, is basically what he's saying. Also the Jimmy Savile, the British Horror Story. This is a two-part series out on Netflix, which you can get actually right now on my BitChute channel, the full two parts of it. We'll have an extract of that tonight, which is pretty shocking. Most importantly, the links exposed between Jimmy Savile and Prince Charles, which are not just links. There is a very, very intimate relationship, all evidenced by letters from Clarence House. And we'll be hearing from the journalist behind that tonight. Also, what about dementia fraud? Scott Smith talks about his own experience with a mum who was classified with dementia, and yet she was still pretty much compos mentis. Social services used that classification in order to try and take control of her property and her bank accounts, etc. And he had to have a bit of a battle with them to get back to being a prime carer for his mum. And also Julian Assange, still, I'm afraid, down there in Belmarsh. Now he's married, although that wasn't on the news that week, was it? Certainly not on the TV news. And we hear the fourth part of four of the interview with RT back in 2011 tonight. Finally, in the first part, got a lot to cram in. I better hurry up, hadn't I? is Tony Greenstein. He is one of the founders of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. He's a Labour campaigner, Jewish guy, who was the first Jew to be kicked out of the Labour Party for anti-Semitism. And he explains why he's quit the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. He also shares his views with us about Keir Starmer and exactly where he's coming from on Israel. In part two, we hear from Liz Truss, her pronouncements about Ukraine. We hear about Scott Ritter, who Martin's just informed me has been booted off of Twitter this week because of his views, even though he's a very, very useful commentator. He's been a brilliant commentator, and you hear some of his commentary tonight. He's the former United States Marine Corps intelligence officer responsible for resigning just before the Iraq war because he knew and he told everybody that there were no weapons of mass destruction there at all. Scott is extremely good on Ukraine, one of the best. Martin and I will have a little gentle discussion about the 25 million people in Shanghai at the moment, in lockdown over in China. And we also look at South Front, the alternative analysis of wars by them, and their look at Ukraine. They've got a pretty grim assessment of it all. But anyway, let's start with this story about the family sex show, Stella, because this is pretty shocking, isn't it? The idea that this is a Bristol produced show from the tobacco factory, which was set up by George Ferguson a couple of decades ago, the former mayor. And the idea is to tour this family sex show all over the country.
Tony, I'm afraid you and me know as much about this as has been on the brand YouTube today. And I'm going to mention the name of the journalist who publicised this morning, is Sonia Paulson, who many people might know has been campaigning against child abuse in high places for many, many years. And she found this particularly shocking. And it's on in May. So there's plenty of time to find out about it, go down maybe protest outside it or something like that, or ask people who are going in why they're taking their children to such a thing. To actually call it a family sex show. There's hiding nothing there, are they?
Well, what they're saying is it's a workshop for families, how mm-hmm. we talk about sex. And I think it's booking now, actually. It starts, I'm not entirely sure, it looks like it starts on the 26th of April, actually at the tobacco factory. But then the idea is to tour around wherever they can with this. So, I mean, what do you think, from having had a listen to Sonia this morning, what do you make of this family sex show?
I'm biased because I'm in the women's movement, so I'm against anything that's harmful for children. There might be other people who think this is completely harmless and just something trendy that the tobacco factory is putting on. But it does say in their blurb that children from 5 years upwards can be brought to it. That's very, very young.
5 years?
Yeah, that's very,
now,
very
listen,
young.
I mean, basically for me, up until sort of, I suppose, 13 years old, any talk or mention of sex, it was just embarrassing. You kind of didn't really want to know because you're not a sexual animal at that age. You're just a person. You're a young person developing.
Well, I think the fact that they're able to do this so openly and literally call it by what it is and not even hide it is because we are now at the culmination of many, many years of sexualising young children and trying to introduce, I'm going to say it, a paedo-apologist agenda into schools and here and in America, more in America than here, because we've managed to hold out against it to some extent.
So the tobacco factory themselves, they say it's a show for families about sex and relationships. Knowing your body helps knowing your rights. Well, a bit patronising, but fun and silly performance about the painfully awkward subject of sex, exploring names and functions, boundaries, consent, pleasure, queerness, sex, gender and relationships, using real life bodies, personal stories, songs and movement. The family sex show puts the good stuff at the forefront of conversation and imagines a future where there's no shame.
But this is all deliberately reducing the boundaries, and the ultimate agenda is to do away with an age of consent and get to a world where children, there is no such thing as a child, really. So if there's no such thing as a child, we can't safeguard children. It's as simple as that.
Martin, I mean, you're teaching children, quite young children yourself, aren't you? I mean, do you think it's the sort of thing that children will actually want to go to, or maybe it's something that adults would take children along because they think it's good for them?
To be honest, I don't know enough about what it is to have a strong opinion about it.
Just giving you as good,
well,
as,
I know, I mean,
a good description as I can.
Well, I mean, what is it?
Real bodies, personal stories, songs and movement.
Yeah.
So They explore names and functions, boundaries, consent, pleasure, queerness, sex, gender, and relationships.
Well, okay. I mean, that's the basic blurb of it. I must admit, if I was a child and I was told I was going to something like that, I'd just yawn with boredom. But there you go. It may well be that people may go to it and get something out of it, or they may not, or there may be an agenda behind it as suggested by Stella, but I don't know. So I'm not going to come out and say anything too much about it, because I don't know anything about it.
Okay, so what they're saying is, at the Tobacco Factory, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Maybe you want to go, maybe you want to have a look. It's just called The Family Sex Show, and it's at the Tobacco Factory Theatre. Knowing your body helps knowing your rights, for kids 5 and above. Well, I wonder. Well, we shall see. But the subject of trans has been in the news this week, with Women's Hour and Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson particularly coming up with an opposition to biological men competing in female sports. Well, I suppose you've got to use this term, haven't you, biological men, rather than men now.
Can we get one thing out of the way? This is not about anti-trans. In many ways, it's not even about trans people. It's about women's rights. This is about women's rights that are being slowly eroded away. It was 100 years ago that we got the vote.
Yeah, well, the women have still got the vote.
Yeah, the vote, you know. The vote is all very well, Tony. This is about eroding boundaries of women and children. Now, because Boris said what he did, we've got a few other ministers are coming out in their own departments.
You've got a copy of today's Daily Mail there.
Yeah, and this is
Martin,
will
you want to read the headline?
Javid, NHS must protect wards for women only.
Right, so going back about 20 years, the NHS were told that they had to have single-sex wards guaranteed. But as I say, I'm using the word again repeatedly tonight, I'm sorry, it's being steadily eroded. And they now have a thing called Annex B in the NHS guidelines, which means that, if somebody says they're a girl and they're a bloke, they can go onto the women's wards. And not only can they go on the women's wards, anybody who points it out is told, you're imagining things, there are no men on this ward. So they're being told that their reality, you know, what they see with their own eyes and hear with their own ears is not real. That is a very, very dangerous tendency. So MPs and peers in Parliament have been campaigning against this for quite some time to get this Annex B rewritten. And it looks like they finally broke through, and Boris has come out and said what he said.
So I suppose what we're saying really here is there's no reason why someone can't say that they are a woman when they're a man, for example, but that doesn't mean give them rights to the other biological women have.
It's more about safeguarding. I mean, this came to a head when Baroness Nicholson stood up in the House of Lords and revealed a case of a woman who was raped on an NHS hospital ward. And the hospital management told the police no rape had been committed because there were no men on the ward, which was a lie. So that was the first case that's come up. There's another 5 or 6 that are being investigated along the same lines. This is not about trans people. This is about safeguarding women.
Let's have a listen to Boris's little speech this week, then.
You've got a number of LGBT charities and campaigners furious with you over the decision to exempt trans children from the ban on conversion therapy. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, I'm sad about their reaction, because these are good organisations with whom we have had, you know, great relations over a long period of time. I'm very proud, by the way, of everything that I've done and our party has done to champion these issues. I was one of the first Conservatives to call for equal marriage. The Conservative government brought it in. I think when I became Foreign Secretary, I insisted that the LGBT flag should fly even in over embassies where, you know, other parts of the world where they didn't necessarily share our values. So I'm 100% committed to this, and we will have a ban on gay conversion therapy, which to me is utterly abhorrent. But there are complexities and sensitivities when you move from the area of sexuality to the question of gender. And I'm afraid there are things that I think still need to be worked out. I'm sorry we haven't been able to reach agreement with the organisations concerned, but that will in no way diminish our determination to tackle prejudice wherever we can.
Was that a hint that you could still end up banning conversion therapy for trans children, or do you think that that's off the table now?
Let me just say, because this is something that, you know, frankly, for people like me, it wasn't something I thought that I would have to consider in great detail. And it's these are novel concepts, and we've got to be clear about that. But I suppose I'll just make a few points. I don't think that it's reasonable for kids to be deemed so-called Gillick competent to take decisions about their gender or irreversible treatments that they may have. I just don't. I think there should be parental involvement at the very least. That's the first thing. Second thing, I don't think that biological males should be competing in female sporting events. And you know, maybe that's a controversial thing to say, but it just seems to me to be sensible. And I also happen to think that women should have spaces which are, whether it's in hospitals or prisons or change rooms or wherever, which are dedicated to women. That's as far as my thinking has developed on this issue. Now, if that puts me in conflict with, you know, some others, then we've got to work it all out. That doesn't mean that I'm not immensely sympathetic to people who want to change gender, to transition, and it's vital that we give people the maximum possible love and support in making those decisions. But these are complex issues, and I don't think they can be solved with one swift, easy piece of legislation. It takes a lot of thought to get this right.
Final question, Prime Minister. You earn a decent salary. If you had some money left over at the end of the month, at the end of the year, would you consider donating to Eton, just as your Chancellor donates to Winchester College?
Look, I think it's an admirable thing to support your place of education and, you know, be true to your school, as the Beach Boys said.
Right, so Stella, I wonder what you make of this. It does seem as if we're talking, particularly with this conversion therapy, about the idea that maybe you can, you know, change your mind about what you think your sex is time and time again. You know, go one way, then say after maybe a few months or a couple of years, say, actually, no, I've changed my mind. I actually want to revert to the original sex that I was when I was born.
Well, I, along with hundreds and hundreds of other people, took part in the consultation, and as I do take part in government consultations when they're on subjects that interest me. This was never about anything to do with prejudice against children who might have what's called gender dysphoria. I had gender dysphoria myself as a teenager. Luckily, all this stuff wasn't around at the time. Otherwise, I would probably be in hospital having surgery, you know, at that age.
Well, they get called tomboys. Yeah. You used to get called tomboys.
Well, yeah, exactly, and there's nothing wrong with that. The main reason Boris has
come
out... By the
way, you also get very sensitive men.
Yeah, you do, and look what's happening to them as well. They're being told they have to turn into girls, which is even worse, or as bad. So Boris has come out with this because there's a campaign going on prior to the local elections called Respect My Sex If You Want My Ex, which is a group of women's organisations that are running that campaign. So quite clearly, he doesn't want his candidates not to be able to answer the question, what is a woman on the doorstep? So it's political expediency that he has come out with this now, but that doesn't take away from the fact that we need ministers to make these statements. We have to draw a line in the sand against this madness, which is harming children across the Anglosphere, not just in this country. I think it's a very bold move. He's the only Prime Minister in the Anglosphere who's spoken up about this. Most of them in Australia, America, when they're confronted with questions like this, they fob it off. They can't answer it. There's a Supreme Court judge right now in America who was asked, what is a woman? And she said, I can't answer that because I'm not a biologist. So, you know, come on. Boris is a student of history. He knows which way the wind blows. He's seen which way the wind is blowing on this, and that's why he said what he said.
Martin, what do you make of Boris saying that actually transgender people who've swapped from being men to women can't compete in or shouldn't be able to compete as women in athletics and the other way around?
Well, it pains me greatly to say this, but I largely agree with the Prime Minister's position. But, that's causing me considerable anguish.
OK. What about changing your mind, though?
Well, absolutely.
This idea of changing your mind, well, you can maybe change it once, twice. How many times can you change your mind
would argue that people should be allowed to decide what their own sexuality is without other people telling them what to do. And if they want to change their mind, that's absolutely up to them. Surely
if they then go for gay conversion therapy, that's where they're saying, well, actually, I want to convert back to being a woman, though I was a man.
We're focusing here on trans matters, but the gay conversion therapy ban is to stop cult Christian organizations, for example, trying to make people in their organizations give up being homosexual. Now, that is actually a common ground.
But don't people sometimes choose to give up being homosexual?
Well, if they choose, that's up to them. But conversion therapy says, you think you're homosexual, but if you pray enough, you won't be.
You can only be part of our church if you go through this,
That's right.
Maybe.
I believe that churches have got exemptions, or they can ask for exemption if this ban is brought in.
That includes for the gay conversion as well.
Yeah, I believe they can ask for exemptions. How is praying harmful,
So. Well, I suppose so. I mean, if people are being made to do stuff against their will, then that is clearly wrong by any definition, isn't it?
It is, and each case would be treated on its merits if
always
they offer an exemption.
Always remember having the faith healers around here having a chat. I think it was one of the dialect shows we did a few years ago, and they showed me a photograph from the BRI of about 8 or 9 nurses sitting around a patient's bed praying for them, which is what they used to do between the wars. So if someone were thinking, well, we don't understand what's wrong with this person, we don't know what to do, so they would pray for them, which is in this day and age, I don't think you would see that going on in there, especially with the sort of people that are running the show.
I imagine there's lots of praying still goes on in hospitals.
Well, by nurses? Do you think you bring the nurses in to pray around someone's bed?
Well, I mean, what harm can that do?
Well, I agree. What harm can it do? But does it happen? I think not. Anyway, look, you wanted also to talk about freedom of information tonight, Stella, because we had an item on last week from Mark Watts, who's like, well, I hate to use the word guru, and he would hate me to use the word guru, but he is he's one of the country's experts on FOI, what works, what to expect, what to do when you're blocked, etc.
Well, I thought that was a great interview you did with him, actually, Tony, great interest. He was covering the mechanics of how you make an FOI, what kind of information you can expect to get. But the most interesting thing was how he was explaining that it's perfectly possible for a government organisation to comply with an FOI request but still not give out the information. And this really rang bells for me, because I've had some run-ins with FOI myself. I don't know how much you want me to go into this, Tony. I'm quite happy to. I've had FOI experience in my own family in a local hospital here in outskirts of Bristol, where a family member was in a locked ward. And he came out with all bruises all over his body and couldn't remember anything about what had happened, because he was drugged up to the eyeballs, of course. Went to our ordinary GP, and she obviously had a look at his injuries. And the interesting thing was that in the course of time that he'd been on this ward, he was taken out of the ward for an X-ray at another hospital with no explanation. I didn't know why he'd been took for an X-ray, so none of us did. So I did FOI request, obviously, to try and get...
So did you ask first?
I didn't know that he'd been sent for an X-ray until after he came out,
Okay. I just wonder, when you do an FOI request, most people would think, well, let me just go and phone up the hospital, phone up the ward, talk to the sisters first, rather than just do an FOI. But you did the FOI first, did you?
I'll tell you why. It's because it was all, agency workers in and out, so it was different people on almost every night of the week. It's very low trained staff, to be quite honest. So, went for the FOI to find out. I wanted... exact ward notes. I wanted all the ward notes, you see, to find out exactly what had gone on, because one day I'd gone in, as usual, to visit him, perfectly all right, in his drugged up state. Next day he was on they'd put him on a walker, one of these walkers, and I couldn't understand why he was on a walker, because there was no history of not being able to walk or being in pain walking. And I said, what the hell is this walker, And I argued about it. I said, look, he's a man over 6 foot. To put him on this walker, he's crouched over. That can't be good for him anyway. I said, if you want him to have support while he's walking, just give him an ordinary walking stick. Which the next day I went in, they had done that. But I didn't know at that time that he'd had these injuries. And he couldn't tell me. He couldn't talk to me, because he didn't really know what was going on around him.
Okay, so what did you find out with the FOI?
I had, obviously, they have 30 days to reply. They fobbed us off. We were just in the start of the first lockdown at this stage, so they were fobbing us off due to COVID. We haven't got people on and it's going to take longer. So that was a common excuse. And I did get the ward notes back. All the interesting bits, which might have been the bit where somebody went into his room to find out what was going on, were all redacted. So because they'd complied with the FOI request, I couldn't get anywhere by saying, oh, can we have those bits unredacted? No, because they've supplied what they think we need to know, you see.
Yeah, but you don't know what they have decided they're not going to tell you. So you don't know if what they've done.
You can have a good idea about it because you know the kind of things they will redact. And the kind of things they will redact are if a member of staff is named, for example, or another patient on the ward is named, for example, or something else, some other accusation has been made, which they think that, you know, hasn't been proved. So after that, I had to have a series of letters, correspondence with the hospital management to try and get some more information, and they basically went into a process of fobbing us off because we were in the lockdowns.
So what did you find out eventually?
I agreed, we had to agree that we weren't going to pursue it in the end. But this is, Tony, is what the people dealing with
FOI... Any idea where all these bruises came from?
Yes, I believe, obviously, that he had a fall in his room in the hospital, and for some reason he wasn't helped or he didn't get help in time.
So he was then taken for an x-ray?
They took him for an x-ray. This is what I presume, but I was trying to get the ward notes to find exactly what happened.
Wouldn't it be lovely if they just contacted the family when something like that happened? Let people know?
Yes, it wasn't very nice to go in the next day, find him on a walker all of a sudden, and
this is a horrific culture, Martin, that's starting to build up, isn't it? That people are much more afraid of, what's going to happen with the family.
I think in this case it was a lot to do with the fact it was all agency workers.
But
this is the NHS.
But this is a sort of litigious, we've got to be nervous of litigation, US-style culture, isn't it?
Well, that's one element of it. I mean, the Freedom of Information Act was passed by the Blair government, and Blair subsequently said, I must have been out of my mind to allow this, because, of course, various government departments and people from hospital wards right up to the sort of Ministry of Defence really don't like it at all. And I was actually on RT about a year ago talking about this, because they've got a particular office in the Cabinet now which deals with all FOI requests which are coming to central government about big stuff, and they manipulate it so that they don't basically let anything out that they don't want out. So in other words, although in theory people are supposed to be allowed to know what's going on, in practice they've got all sorts of ways of making sure you never find out.
They probably have a chat at the coffee machine or the bar with the nudge unit, don't they?
Up until a year and a half ago, I was working for a government department down here at Temp Quay, and we all had training on how to deal with FOI requests when they came in. As you say, Tony Blair brought it in, but then what happened was that GDPR came in from the European Union, and GDPR really put a big spanner in the works, because it was no longer a simple thing. You know, the idea of GDPR was, when it started, was that people could find out what information was being held on them by a government department and have it redacted, have it took off the system or redacted or whatever. And that interfered with the process of asking for FOI requests, you see. It kind of was almost at odds with it. So what the government departments did to cope with both of those things was simply go into their systems and start deleting, and you will find most government departments now don't hold any information on anything which is more than 2 years old.
Well, what about the deletion of all the records of the attempts to prosecute Jimmy Savile by the Crown Prosecution Service under Keir Starmer? Maybe that had something to do with that. A lot of this information, of course, is key because it has evidence of criminal activity potentially within public office, which are, I mean, actually malfeasance is still life in prison, perversion of the course of justice, all this sort of thing. And all the records, oh dear, they've all disappeared. Anyway, a lot of problems generally dealing with these government agencies of various sorts, particularly since 2008, since the bailout of the banks and the government being constantly penny-pinching, all that stuff. But anyway, one of the people I spoke to this week, he had a rather bad experience. He's from the Northwest with his mother, and he believes that the social services actually classified her, without telling him or any other members of the family, as having dementia. picture and then tried to take control of her goods and effects and this sort of thing. He only lived on the opposite side of the road, so he was able to keep a very close eye on what was going in. But here is Scott Smith, and there'll be a longer interview up on our show page tonight with Scott to explain his battle with social services over his mum.
I then had a meeting with a manager from the DWP and explained to the manager from the DWP what I'd done. She agreed that what I'd done was the right thing to do and advised me also to go and get power of attorney. So, as I say, I've rung the social services, told them what I've done, and I've asked them, would they help me, because I didn't know anything about it, to get power of attorney. And they said they couldn't because mum already lacked capacity. Now, apparently, when she'd told the GP or whoever it was who diagnosed her with dementia, that at the time she was diagnosed, this is what I was told, she had capacity. So it's a bit confusing when you can be diagnosed with dementia but still have capacity. I'm refused the opportunity for a power of attorney, and a couple of days later, I've received a letter from the DWP to say that I was no longer mum's financial deputy. So basically what had happened is this social worker had made fraudulent claims against me of me committing fraudulent money activity. And she held a meeting in private with the police and the DWP and themselves, obviously the adult social services, with claims that I was committing fraudulent money activity. And basically they self-appointed themselves financial deputy for me mum without any court of protection application or any power of attorney. They just self-appointed themselves financial deputies.
Okay, Scott, just let me intervene a sec there, because it sounds to me like what's happened is the social services have taken over your mother's affairs. And I don't quite understand what gives them the right to do that under your nose, because quite clearly you are much closer to your mum and you are much more likely to do what she wants than they are.
Absolutely. So yeah, this is what they did, and basically they took control of a pension, and they froze a bank account. Now when she passed away, apparently the bank account was never frozen. But I'm saying she froze the bank account because when the card arrived, I've gone down to the bank to get my mum some money. I put the card in the machine, put the password in, and it just swallowed the card. So I went to the bank the next day, and this manager came out and said, the account's frozen, and you need to go to the court of protection. So I've gone home, and I've told my mum, and she's like, I should be getting money here. Where's my pension? So I said, yeah, mum, let's ring the social services. Because now I'm starting to, you know, it's all starting to, like, click into place. So I rung her and I said, at the time I rung her, I've had no knowledge of this meeting, do you know what I mean? I got the knowledge of the meeting from a subject access request. I've rung the social services, and my mum's saying to her, you know, where's my money? She's going, you can't have it. Just made a load of it. I can't remember the precise things she said, but my mum was upset, and I just said to the woman, I said, you're out of order what you've done. I'm going to seek legal advice, but apparently what they did was legal. So the next thing is I get an envelope in the door. At my house, with 60 quid in it. The note just saying, for provisions for your mum. So I've told my mum, and my mum's took that money. And then a few days later, there's another 60 quid. And by this time I'd woke up, I thought, hang on a minute. You stuck 60 quid through the door with a note saying, provisions for your mum. Where did that 60 quid come from? Do you know what I mean? What, you know, and there needs to be a paper trail for that 60 quid, but at the moment, it's not very professional. So I kept hold of that 60 quid. I've still got it. Still got it in an envelope put away. So for 7 months nearly, we had no access to any of Mum's money. So I've looked after it. I've fed it and I've clothed it. And I've made the conscious decision to keep all the receipts. And then come about December time, I got a letter through the door saying we're applying to the Court of Protection for your mum's property and affairs. So I've contacted them and I've arranged a meeting. Now, by this time, this agency social worker, because I'm putting them under pressure now, I'm recording everything. I'm recording everything, every meeting, every telephone call. This agency social worker vanishes, goes on the sick or something, disappears, and this new one. But I'm unaware of this until we have the meeting. So we have this meeting, and this one's like, "Hi, my name's..." I'm like, "Where have you come from? Where's the other one? You know, why haven't you told me? You know, how long have you been appointed to me, Mum? You know, all the normal questions that you should ask," and she didn't have an answer. But with the meeting in mind, I'd had a couple of weeks to, prove that Mum wasn't... She was ill, and yes, she was starting to get really forgetful, but she wasn't totally incapacitated. To the point where, after the phone call asking why they'd frozen the bank account, Mum said, "Right, we need to make a will." And she got the neighbours in and we made a will. So, although she's lacked capacity, she had the presence of mind to realise that something was going on and to make a will.
So anyway, this is a grey area, isn't it? This whole idea of dementia. In fact, sometimes people can kind of float in and float out of dementia, but it does sound as if there are decisions being made completely out with the family, and one would have hoped that social services would have been working with the family, Stella.
Gosh, what a story. That's just unbelievable, isn't it? There has to be something that went wrong at an early stage, you know, the bit where he was going to try and get power of attorney. That's where things went wrong, wasn't it?
Well, I think the lesson is get power of attorney before somebody else, like social services or whatever, says that your relative has got dementia.
Yeah, and this whole business, about trying to get control of the property, that's obviously because in case she had to get 24-hour to care, that they would have sold the property to fund it, or let the local council have some kind of hold in it. It's just unbelievable, isn't it, that he wasn't consulted. And
well, I mean, she was shut out of the process, I think. Martin, yeah. This does seem like, you know, sometimes social services aren't really working as they should do with the family. They almost see the family as, you know, the enemy, where actually they know their loved one better than anybody else.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a particular case, this, and it's got particular features. But one of the things that strikes me is all this agency social work. This is casualisation of what should be a very, very, you know, a job that actually demands non-casualisation, people who know the families, rather than people being moved in and out.
So also, Scott has some... I suppose, but I did ask him in the longer interview, which will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, lots in there about, you know, Scott's life with his mum, etc., and about how to avoid the idea of being defrauded of property, etc., and control over your loved one's affairs by legal means, how to make sure that doesn't happen.
It's difficult for families to discuss money, isn't it? But... you know, the families need to set the differences aside and to discuss these things, because, you know, not only was it my mum's property, right, but traditionally it was my inheritance. You know, my mum was born in 1930, my dad was born in 1925. It was that generation that helped build this country after the war. It was that generation that worked to give the siblings a start in life, which was usually, if it wasn't a house to be sold to give them a start in life, it was a house for them to continue to live in and to keep in the family. So people need to discuss what's going to happen. Power of attorney is very, very important. And I think the most important thing, and what I've done with my property, is I've put it into trust. So it's not mine anymore. It belongs to the trust. And I think that's the only way you can guarantee that any assets are going to be passed on through generations. Don't let them go to social services, your family. Try and look after your family members if you can. I know it's difficult, but try. And if you have to deal with social services, record absolutely everything from the first meeting, record it.
I see some of the similar sort of advice that we had last week from Dr. Mark Jones on a similar topic about grappling for their inheritance and having trouble with people kind of interfering and in the way. Scott Smythe there is saying we must record things. This is the most important thing to do. If it's recorded, then you've got clear evidence of a discussion that's taken place. Anyway, lots of lessons there, and I'll put a link up to the full interview on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Anyway, moving now to look at the Labour Party activist. Well, he's been booted out of the Labour Party. Left-wing activist, I suppose we have to say. Tony Greenstein down in Brighton, we have on here from time to time. And he is notorious, I suppose you have to say, as the first Jew to be removed from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism, so-called anti-Semitism, which was not anti-Semitism at all. Of course, there's many, many others have followed. And Martin, one of the things that Tony says in the longer version of the interview is actually that most of the people being accused of and ejected from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism are in fact now Jews.
Well, that's because the Zionist lobby, which are behind all of this, want to particularly punish anti-Zionist Jews, so they've been singled out for this treatment.
What do you make of this, Stella? Is there any sense behind it? What's the motive?
It's bizarre. I can't. I really can't speak much to this, to be honest. I'm not. I haven't been a member of the Labour Party for some time. But is this going back to the Corbyn after the Corbyn?
I think Greenstein has been in the crosshairs of the Zionist lobby for longer than that,
right?
Because of his pro-Palestinian activism, and that's what's drawn attention.
Yeah, he's also a very frequent blogger. I think even he might have even had a spot on the Guardian at one point. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Tony's talk this week, which is explaining why he has now left the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which 40 years ago he helped form.
Well, the way it was done was disgraceful, and it was rammed through a conference, a Zoom conference, where no one could see each other, no one could speak or chat with each other or contact each other, so they had no horizontal contact. And the only people who had any contact with the members who attended were the executive and the small officers group, including its director, Ben Jamal, who had direct access to them. So it was a classical mechanism of control, and Zoom offers all sorts of possibilities to those who are control freaks to control the agenda and the meetings. I mean, we see that in the Labour Party, where meetings have been shut down or people arbitrarily removed by Labour Party bureaucrats on Starmer's orders. It's as simple as that. So this technology can be very good and very useful, and we can see each other like we are doing now, and you can contact people and have speakers from abroad very easily in a way you couldn't do with physical meetings. But there are democratic drawbacks to it as well, and PSE exploited it to the maximum. I mean, the problem with the Constitution is that it gives more power to the executive. The executive draws up all the regulations, the code of conduct, all the methods of controlling its members. So instead of the executive being accountable to the membership, it's a membership which is becoming accountable to the executive. And that's exactly not the way to build a mass movement in support of the Palestinians. If that mass movement doesn't have democracy at its core, it will go nowhere. And one of the consequences there is the political blindness of those who run Palestine Solidarity Campaign. They really believe that if they win the battle of public opinion, then the government will shift. Well, the governments don't shift because of public opinion unless it's in their interest to do so. So British foreign policy is really not susceptible to public opinion unless there is a mass campaign from below. And that's what PSC will never do and cannot do. And that's why it has condemned Palestine Action. It's waged an 18-month war against Palestine Action, a small group which grew up, a direct action group, and has had remarkable success against Israel's Elbit arms factories, which are situated in Britain. One of them, Oldham, has been forced to close because they simply could not operate. And that is a very, I don't say that's the only tactic that can be used. There are many things you can do, but direct action is an important component of any campaign, as it was against apartheid, with people running onto rugby pitches, threatening cricket pitches and so on. So to rule it out, as PSC have done in practice, and to show utter contempt for the membership, meant that I, as one of the co-founders, felt I could no longer be a member.
But this is a fast-moving world, Tony. I mean, the executive will say, won't they, look, we need a bit more power as an executive in order to move things along quickly. We can't go around, you know, consulting all the members on every single move. This makes us a more live and able to react to events as they happen.
Well, unfortunately, that's not true. If anything, they've been very slow to react to events. All the major victories have happened in many ways despite Palestine solidarity. In Brighton, we had a two-year-long campaign against SodaStream, which was an Israeli multinational which had a shop in Brighton. They'd opened it. And we had the Sussex Friends of Israel and all sorts of Zionists come down from London and elsewhere to join the Zionists in a counter-picket. But after 2 years, we prevailed. The company pulled out. We got really no support from the executive of Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And I say that has been the same with Palestine Action. When it came to the anti-Semitism campaign, which I'm sure you're aware of, since 2015, it was launched against Jeremy Corbyn, but it's had far wider ramifications. PSC was simply nowhere to be seen. It was completely intimidated by the campaign. And so the constitution, which I reject, with the new constitution, defines anti-Semitism in Britain now as a form of racism on a par with Islamophobia and any other form of racism. And it's not. Anti-Semitism in Britain is a form of prejudice. It's not a form of state racism, which is the kind of racism that really counts, where people get deported because of the colour of their skin or their origin. Jews are not harassed by the police in the same way that black people or Muslims are. So there are all sorts of reasons. And PSC is unable, if you like, to work with anti-racist organisations. Black Lives Matter passed it by. So it's extremely slow to react. And that's the problem when you're not democratic. You're not accountable. And people cannot actually have influence from the grassroots. And that's what's important in any campaign, the grassroots membership.
Well, two points covered there, really, pretty comprehensively by Tony Greenstein, blogger. Full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later on, Martin. One is the change of the constitution by Zoom of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign at the beginning, putting more power in the hands of their executive and less in the hands of the members. And secondly, the practical, what he believes is ineffectiveness of the campaign.
Well, I'm not a member of PSC, although I've been a supporter of the many PSC actions in Bristol, and we've got a very active PSC chapter here, as it were. I mean, I listen to what he's saying there. I mean, these kind of arguments remind... I mean, I've been involved in political movements and campaigns for decades, and these kind of arguments are perennial about how you should organise, how much democracy you're going to have or not have, whether what you're doing is effective. I mean, you think back to the 1950s and 1960s, there was mainstream CND, and then you've got, you know, the Committee of 100 that wanted to carry out direct action. And in fact, what you need to do is to have a nest of organisations so that the more mainstream people can go on doing their mainstream stuff and other people who want to do more radical stuff need to do their more radical stuff in such a way that it doesn't mess up the mainstream campaign.
I mean, one of the
campaign.
Obvious sort of things that he's discussing here, really, in the background to everything he's saying, is that Palestine Solidarity Campaign has been intimidated by the Israel lobby.
Well, that may be so. I mean, I'm not going to comment on that.
And they've caved in on various areas to what the Israel lobby wants them to do.
Well, look at Gilad Atzmon, for example, who's been on this show. He's very critical of all of this from a, you know, he's a Jew, but he doesn't identify as a Jew. There's going to be a spectrum of opinion from more radical to less radical in any group or organisation. The question is, it's like a game of football. How do you make all these different moving parts fit together in such a way that you achieve your goals? And it's actually easy to say and difficult to do.
So anyway, one of the founders of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign back in 1982, Tony Greenstein, has decided, I've had enough of it. Palestine Action is the one. They are actually doing stuff, and people should leave Palestine Solidarity Campaign and join Palestine Action, which is working. And we'll hear Stella's comments on this after we've heard from Tony Greenstein talking about what he believes is going on in the Labour Party now under Keir Starmer.
Well, if you remember rightly, Keir Starmer came to power became leader of the Labour Party, promising to root out anti-Semitism, which of course was a lie because there was no anti-Semitism or trivial amount, nothing to be bothered about any more than historically there's been far greater anti-Semitism, if you want to know. It was about removing opponents of Israel. I mean, Starmer said he's a Zionist without qualification in an interview with the Times of Israel. And so what he's doing is removing Jewish people who are opponents of Zionism or Israel as part of a wider purge of the left as a whole. So that's why if you're in the Labour Party today and you're Jewish, you're five times more likely to be expelled than if you're not Jewish. I mean, that's Starmer's war on anti-Semitism. But people call Boris Johnson a liar, which he is, but they don't call Starmer a liar. And I just invite anyone to go onto the web and pulled down the 10 pledges, which are still on Starmer's website for some reason. Every single one of them he's broken. He promised to increase corporation tax for companies, and when Johnson did that, he opposed it. And he talked about a Prevention of War Act and all the rest of it. We haven't heard much of that lately in terms of Ukraine. So, I mean, you have two parties which are virtually identical, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and that's really what it's about. It's about making the Labour Party safe for capitalism, safe for imperialism, and of course you expel any Jews or non-Jews who aren't Zionists or oppose Zionism.
So do you think the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, after this constitutional change, Tony, is actually going to be able to make any difference whatsoever for the Palestinian cause?
I don't think it will make much difference. I mean, it's an organisation which has raises enough money. It employs, I think, 12 staff. And yet its ability to campaign and the campaign it's waged have been minimal. It failed remarkably to support David Miller at Bristol University. I think you're particularly aware of that campaign because that's where you are based. It bought into the whole anti-Semitism nonsense that David Miller's theories about power groups and lobby groups was somehow anti-Semitic. How can it be? What he's doing is researching into what is true. I mean, these groups do operate. They are dangerous. They should be opposed. I just don't think people should get them out of proportion and they should see where their power originates. But, you know, I mean, groups like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and McCarthyite campaigns, whose whole aim and purpose is to cancel those they don't like. You know, the latest target is Loki. It was Ken Loach. It was Shahed Abu-Salama at Sheffield University and so on. So that's what the Zionists are about. They're about cancelling people, but they are a direct threat to freedom of speech in this country. There's no doubt. The Board of Deputies, which is the main Zionist organisation, only represents a minority of Jews. It's not democratic. It's not elected. Every time someone who is anti-Zionist wants to speak at a public meeting, the Board of Deputies try to get the meeting cancelled, try to get the premises to withdraw permission to speak. Now, that was before COVID, of course. Zoom now has taken over. But yes, I mean, that's really what it's about, isn't it? So Zionism, not only in Britain, but in the United States with its attempt to make BDS illegal. It's amazing. As soon as Russia invades Ukraine, which I don't support, but mass sanctions automatically imposed on Russia. No one says they're racist. And yet, if you advocate sanctions against Israel, that's automatically branded anti-Semitic, which is rubbish. They make the comparison with the SA's siege on Jewish shops in Berlin 1933. What they fail to miss or understand is that in 1933, when Hitler came to power, Jews across the world launched an international boycott in Nazi Germany. And who was opposed? The Zionist movement. They preferred to trade with Hitler than to topple him. That's the sad reality.
So that's Tony Greenstein there, Labour activist. Stella, what do you make of what he's saying there?
Oh, Tony, no, I'm going to pass on this one. I don't know enough about it. I'll definitely hand it over to you.
Martin?
Well, I mean, he's obviously a very experienced activist of very long standing.
It's an interesting point he's making about sanctions, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
The idea that there's a campaign of what called boycott, divestment, sanctions, which apparently is anti-Semitic. Basically, you're a Nazi if you're advocating for that boycott, divestment and sanctions on Israel. And yet we've just had a month and a half of mass sanctions on Russia.
And on Venezuela and on Iran. And on Iraq before we invaded it. Yes, I mean, sanctions are one of the tools that, you know, are political tools that can be used. But why should Israel be somehow exempt from that? It's absurd. Serbia was sanctioned before we bombed them in order to liberate Kosovo. You know, it's the hypocrisy with all is unbelievable. One of the things that particularly riles me as still a member of the Labour Party is that Keir Starmer, when he took over, and I actually voted for him, there was a court case against the party from people who worked for the party, apparatchiki, who claimed that they'd been discriminated against and there was anti-Semitism against them. The legal advice the party was given that if it went to court, they would lose. That was the legal advice the party had been given. And that's what Ken Livingston also pointed out. But instead of going to court, and therefore, you know, not having to pay any money, they paid these people, who were essentially saboteurs of the Labour Party, millions of pounds, which now then completely destroyed the party's finances and makes it difficult for them to fight local elections, general elections, etc. And now, you know, there's a political problem now for the Labour Party with no money. Although, of course, at the height of the Corbyn era, the party was rolling in cash. And now it's absolutely bankrupt. And that is because these people have been paid off millions of pounds. And that is absolutely outrageous, because if it had gone to court, they wouldn't have got a penny.
A campaign to scrap the role of Bristol Mayor is to launch this week, ahead of the referendum next month. Doesn't seem like there's been much of a campaign here. Maybe it's because there's not much money to go on advertising and lobbying the press to take an interest in it. Bristol will be going to the polls on Thursday, the 5th of May, to decide whether to scrap the mayoral system after opposition councillors had a victory in City Hall in December 2021. The majority of elected members in Bristol City Council backed a motion to hold a legally binding second referendum to decide how the council should be run from 2024 onwards. The vote will take place 10 years after the first referendum, which created the post of mayor in Bristol in 2012. Now, Stella, I've just got my polling card through the other day. Yeah. I'm not sure that this is going to be a massive turnout, though, because there are no other elections going on. And so far, very little campaign.
No, but it doesn't really matter, does it? Because we don't have this thing. We don't have any kind of limit on low turnouts in Britain. 10 people could go out to vote, and if six of them have voted one way, then that will be the result. In terms of low turnouts, I vividly remember when we had the vote for alternative vote in Bristol, and that was a national vote, and we had incredibly low turnout in Bristol, something like 20% of people.
We did. I mean, one of the biggest ever turnouts, of course, was the vote for Brexit. I suppose people think the referendum, because people think that actually means something. A lot of the time, as we were hearing, Martin, from Tony Greenstein is there, that they think, and Tony Greenstein is saying, that the Labour Party is now safe for capitalism, and therefore it's, you know, that people just don't want to vote when there's what they would call upper sames, two similar parties, and they don't think there's much difference between them.
Well, I mean, to pick up on Stella's point, there was one, the referendum for devolution in Scotland, which was passed, which was took place in the, I think, the early 90s. There were rules there that there had to be a certain amount of turnout, and they also had to reach at least 40%. And in actual fact, the referendum in favour, the people voted in favour of devolution, but they didn't have a sufficient majority for it to be carried through. So in other words, you could make rules about this. You could say, well, if enough people don't turn out for this, we're not going to change it. But as you say, the default position in Britain is whoever turns out, and that's it.
Isn't the media largely responsible for how many people turn out for a vote? You know, whether there's a big campaign or not, whether people are seeing it in the newspapers, seeing it on the TV, hearing it on the radio, seeing it on billboards, surely that determines whether people actually even know it's happening.
Well, yes. I mean, and of course, what tends to happen in general elections is that people do, like many people, don't bet, but they're going to bet on the Grand National, which I think is this weekend. Yeah. So there's a, you know, they participate in a national election because they quite rightly perceive that that is where the real power lies. And that's the point of, you know, certainly true as a Labour activist knocking on doors, you know that you're going to get a lot more people responding to a general election than to a local election. And I think the problem with the mayoral issue is that it's of great interest to the very politically active in the city, many of whom come on this show. Mm-hmm. But loads of people out there, I have to be honest with you, don't really care.
Yeah, what I found interesting, and I think I saw it in the Bristol Post actually, is that there's going to be two choices on the for this vote: either keep the mayor or revert to the committee system that we had before 2010, in other words, before the coalition government. So you're talking at the end of the Blair era, when Blair actually put the kibosh on the old committee system. It sounds like the alternative. It sounds like enough people have, want to go back to that we've actually got on the vote. I will certainly be voting for that.
Yeah, me too. So I'm supposed to be unbiased, but obviously I will try and get Marvin Rees on. I'll put in a little message to see if he will come in and have a chat with us, although I'm not his favourite person since I exposed some dodgy dealings from his family past. You know, when... maybe we better not go there right now, but I mean, it was basically to do with the anti-apartheid leader in Bristol in the 1980s being macheted, allegedly, by the mayor's father, who was involved in drug dealing in St. Paul's. But this sort of thing, the idea is, I mean, this is all based on articles, newspaper articles at the time. And what some people have said, and we did a whole programme about this particular mayor, and it's not about Marvin Rees, it's about the system. But the thing is, he just will not come. He doesn't want to come on the any programmes.
He thinks you're going to ask him some hard questions,
well,
Tony.
Well, exactly, that's the problem, and that's what I do to everybody. I did it to George Ferguson. I used to quite like sparring with George Ferguson when he was mayor, and he would call me Conspiracy Tony. And, you know, that's fine. You say what you want, folks. Anyway, so we're going to look now at where Boris Johnson was yesterday at Hinckley Point. A bit of an embarrassment over the last week. There's been a mass walkout at Hinckley Point, the construction site for Hinckley C nuclear power station, to announce his great new energy policy. It would have been very embarrassing if there'd been a strike going on down there when he'd come to do that. But workers employed by the nuclear plant's main civil engineering contractor expressed concerns over working arrangements. There'd been a strike down there. The dispute saw hundreds of workers at Hinckley C walk out over concerns about working arrangements. 200 to 300 workers employed by the $23 billion plant's main civil engineering contractor Bylor, BYLOR, a partnership between construction firms Lang O'Rourke and French counterpart Bouygues, B-O-U-Y Bouygues, Travaux Publics, were involved in the stand down last Friday. But anyway, they're back at work now. What do you make of Hinckley C, the construction project? Do you think it's an important part, a wonderful thing for the future?
Funny enough, all the way back 2013-14, when I actually joined the government department, which I suppose I better name, the planning inspectorate, Hinckley Point C was the very first team I was ever on national infrastructure, actually. And that's, that's 8-9 years ago. And it's still almost hardly off the drawing board. And this is how long planning takes in this country. I mean,
this is construction in this case, isn't it?
I mean,
the other thing, of course, is that these are kind of relatively new reactors. Martin, what do you make of this dispute? We were just hearing this dispute down at Hinkley, all cleared up just in time for Boris to come up and make a big announcement about energy policy.
Well, it's the first I've heard of it, and obviously I'm glad to see that workers feel that they have the right to do that and that, that hopefully they got what they wanted. The question of whether we should be building it at all is another matter, isn't it?
OK, so let's have a listen now to Boris's great announcement down at Hinkley yesterday about the new... I mean, one thing, listen out here, because Boris makes a completely ridiculous historical error where he talks about the atom being split in Britain first. It wasn't split in Britain. It was split in Berlin in the 1930s, before it was split in Britain, if you want to split hairs, Boris. But he seems to think that it was us in Britain that split the atom. No, Boris, it wasn't. It was Germany. Anyway, let's give him a go.
Doing is a huge amount to help people with the immediate cost of living, and of course we're going to do more. But this is about tackling some of the mistakes of the past and making sure that we are set well for the future. We're no longer subject to, we're never again subject to the vagaries of the global oil or gas price. We can't be subject to blackmail, as it were, from people such as Vladimir Putin. We have energy security here in the UK. So it's a massive strategy for delivering 50 gigawatts, that's almost half the total electricity capacity of this country, from offshore wind by 2030, totally reviving the nuclear industry, which I'm afraid has been more or less moribund in this country. This is the home of nuclear energy. We first split the atom in the UK. We had the first civilian nuclear power plant. We're bringing nuclear home with one nuclear plant and one nuclear reactor every year for 8 years rather than one a decade. What we're also doing is making sure that we take a sensible, pragmatic view about hydrocarbons. We have domestic hydrocarbons. For the interim, we've got to make sure that we, for the interim period, we transition to net zero. We've got to make sure that we use them sensibly as well, and license stuff in the North Sea rather than importing, you know, higher carbon fossil fuels from abroad, from Russia amongst other places. But be in no doubt, this is a massively green strategy as well. By 2030. 95% of our electricity will be from low-carbon sources. And talk about offshore wind. What we're doing on offshore wind will mean we'll be able to power more than all the homes in this country just by offshore wind.
That's Boris speaking yesterday about his energy policy, but, you know, it really annoys me when he says the British split the atom. Nuclear fission was discovered on Monday the 19th of December 1938, by German chemist Otto Hahn and his assistant Fritz Strassmann, in cooperation with Austrian-Swedish physicist Lisa Meitner. He understood that a burst of the atomic nuclei had occurred. The atom had been split in Berlin, not in Britain. Anyway, never mind, poor old Boris, go back to school. But what do you make of this policy, Martin? He's now saying we're going to have a lot of new nuclear power stations all across the country, building one every year.
Well, as I often say when I'm asked about this, they tried to privatise the British nuclear industry in the 1980s, and I wrote a paper for the New Economics Foundation about it. And the reason they couldn't privatise it is because nobody could see a way to make a profit out of it. It's basically an extremely inefficient way to boil water. This is what we're talking about, really. And the only reason that it is viable is because of the sunk costs that you've put into it. I mean, a place like France, where they've spent so much money developing state-owned nuclear power, once you've built the damn things, you've got to use them for their full natural life, otherwise you've wasted all the money on them, which is one of the problems with the German policy at the current time, because after Fukushima, the sort of green sentiment in Germany led to them, let's close down nuclear power stations right away. Whereas, of course, in other countries, even if you want to get rid of it, you take your time because you've got all the sunk costs in it. And, of course, the waste, which is the real problem, isn't going to go away. So if you switch the power station off, you've still got to deal with the waste. So underlying all of this is, you know, basically this, it's the what's happened this week is that there's a massive revolution going on in the financial and energy sectors because of the Russian decision to demand payment for their energy in rubles. And this is going to smash any calculations that are being made about how much energy is going to cost and what we're going to do in 2 years' time, 20 years' time, 25 years' time. And of course, none of that was in his, he's just fantasizing there about we could be energy self-sufficient. It's like, right, yeah, really? Why is that, how's that going to happen?
Well, the other thing about this is that if the cost of energy is going up, which we know it is, suddenly this nuclear starts to become a little bit more viable.
Well, maybe, and the same would be also possibly true of liquid natural gas supplied by the Americans.
The only,
but the only way you can get it
is the country is not going to be viable.
No, well, I'm, so what I was going to say is if you were going to build, the Americans and the Europeans are now saying, and Britain agrees with them, that we're going to build all these terminals for natural gas to come from the US. There's loads of problems with this. There isn't enough. The price is going to be absurd and far higher than any other, than buying from the Russians. And the other problem is nobody wants to invest in it because if there is a peace break, it breaks out and the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is turned on, then all the investment is completely null and void. Now, this points to the fact that, in fact, energy infrastructure decisions are not market decisions. They're ultimately political decisions, and it's to do with who's best friends with who, and it's nothing to do with what's the cheapest energy.
What do you make of the new decisions to move towards, well, we're hearing nuclear, wind, hydrogen, solar, oil and gas and heat pumps are the main parts of the new strategy, with nuclear at the top still?
Well, one a year, are you kidding me? I mean, Hinkley, as I said, it's hardly off the drawing board in sort of 10 years. I mean, one a year, no. I mean, up the road here, we've got Rolls-Royce, and they're talking about making mini-nuclear reactors, and that might be more the way we go in the future. In fact, you know, I think even... And Germany went down a road which, you know, it was all great idea at the time, passive houses and thermal heating and all this. It just, I don't think they, you can get it, it, you can't get it done quick enough. For a whole country, I think that's the problem, isn't it?
Okay, now we're going to have a listen to the a clip from this Jimmy Savile film. It's called Prince Charles. And actually, no, it's not called Prince Charles. It's called Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story. And here is the journalist from the Yorkshire Post, Alison Bellamy, explaining the explosive documents that she has revealed to the documentary makers at Netflix about Prince Charles's very, very close relationship with Jimmy Savile, to the extent that basically Savile was running the PR for Prince Charles.
I was a journalist. When I worked at the Yorkshire Evening Post, I was the Jimmy Savile correspondent covering all his news and charity fundraising antics. Called me as a joke his head of media or good news girl. I did like him. You know, we got on, I looked forward to seeing him. It was a thrill to see Jim will fix it sort of thing. It was like seeing your childhood hero. I did know a lot about him, really, so I was asked by a book publisher to write his biography. This is research I used for writing the book, and I've not been in here for years, actually. So there's the book I wrote. It was published in the June of 2012, 3 months before the scandal erupted. After the scandal, I was shown all of this stuff. Lots of letters here. He kept everything, you know, meticulously. So these letters from the royal family, they, including Prince Charles and Princess Diana. A letter to Jimmy Savile, to his London flat at Park Crescent. Written on the 4th of July 1991. Dear Jimmy, I can't tell you how grateful I am for the most useful assistance you provided for my speech in the Guildhall the other day. It really was extremely good of you to take the trouble to put together those splendid notes, and they provided me with considerable food for thought. With renewed and heartfelt thanks, yours ever, Charles. January the 2nd, 1989, from the Prince of Wales to Jimmy. I can't remember if I have written you a note recently about morale-boosting visits to projects that don't get enough attention. I have a dreadful feeling the office doesn't consult you before each programme meeting. You know, he's asking this advice, where should he go and visit? Who should he see? So he obviously valued Jimmy's opinion, which is bizarre, really, when he's got the big, you know, the staff. He's got advisors and assistant advisors and, you know, a big team of people. April 1990, seeking Jimmy's advice about a speech. You are so good at understanding what makes people operate and wonderfully sceptical and practical. Can you cast an eye over this draft and let me know how we can best appeal to people on this score? January 14th, 1987. I so want to get to parts of the country that others don't meet. What I really need is a list of suggestions from you. Perhaps I am wrong, but you are the bloke who knows what's going on.
A few years since I was here, I'll tell you.
Aye.
My word.
He was still a man of the people. He knew the common folk. The royal family. They're often seen as stuffy and out of touch. Charles has bound his link with the people of Britain.
Honorary managers, with all sincerity, I've been looking forward to today for some considerable time. If only for one reason, and that is I'm getting more wages for today than I ever got in all the time I worked down the pit.
I mean, it's not just a couple, you know, it's not just three or four, there's absolutely loads of files of it. December 22nd, 1989. I wonder if you would ever be prepared to meet my sister-in-law, the Duchess of York. I can't help feeling that it would be extremely helpful to her if you could. I feel she could do with some of your straightforward common sense.
54 minutes after they'd taken off, without warning or distress signal, the airliner started to disintegrate over Lockerbie.
January 27th, 1989, a month after the Lockerbie disaster. This is Jimmy giving PR advice to the royal family about how to react publicly when there's a major incident in Britain.
I suppose that statistically, something like this has got to happen at some stage on a time.
But of course, it only affects the community in a very small way.
Jimmy advises the Queen should be informed in advance of any proposed action by family members. Jimmy suggests they should have a coordinator who's a special person with considerable experience in such matters. There must be an incident room with several independent phone lines, teletext, etc. I mean, Jimmy is advising them how to do it. What they should do, how they should act, what they should they say anything. So Charles says to Jimmy, I attach a copy of my memo on disasters, which incorporates your points, and I showed to my father, and he showed it to Her Majesty. Jimmy had sent back to Charles a five-part manual titled Guidelines for Members of the Royal Family and Their Staff. Jimmy seems to be a kind of unofficial chief advisor to the Prince of Wales.
So that's Alison Bellamy from originally the Yorkshire Post, Savile's biographer. Of course, it's not really worth reading that biography, potentially, because most of the information she's found out about Savile, she found out afterwards because people came to her with that information. But she finishes up there, Stella, saying that he was chief advisor to the Prince of Wales for many years, unofficially.
Well, you know, it was always rumours that he had this access, wasn't there, to Buckingham Palace and the other royal residences. And I mean, of course, you go on media, social media now, and it's all. We don't know whether to believe a lot of this, but a lot of it, inferences of child trafficking and royal connections with that, paedophilia in high places. Yeah, he could have been a linchpin. He could actually have been a fixer. His connections were unbelievable. He was like the tentacles of an octopus. Politics, everything.
Yeah, I mean, well, the other thing I think to mention is it's not just the Jimmy Savile. There's many others, or several others at least. We had Bishop Ball. I'm not sure, I can't remember his first name, the Bishop of Gloucester. And, of course, Gloucester is where Prince Charles has his residence at Highgrove up near Tetbury. So his own bishop of his county, he was also a paedophile, and he was actually prosecuted and jailed for it. And Prince Charles tried to stop that happening by writing letters to character references for him. But Martin, this is a pretty devastating documentary for Prince Charles, and also a brilliant piece of work, which we don't really see happening in the UK these days. This is a US documentary.
Obviously, I haven't seen the documentary, but I'm aware of the allegations against Saville. The question of paedophilia in high places, I always mention the Kinkora boys' home in Northern Ireland, where MI5 were definitely using young boys as honey traps to blackmail loyalist paramilitaries. And I believe that the real story behind elite paedophilia is the use of paedophilia by the intelligence services for blackmail purposes.
But there is also another side to all of this, and that is that powerful people, they can become megalomaniacs, can't they, where they see children as innocents to, I mean, I would suggest, you know, maybe with Saville, for example, you know, that gives them a sense of more power, having power over children, you know, that because these are the innocents and they like to have power over them.
Well, there may be reasons, you know, there's obviously, you know, personal proclivities involved in this, but the significance is why is it covered up?
Yeah, let's be clear. We're talking here about evil. What is going on here is not just, oh, it's a bit of a, you know, misdemeanor, whatever. There's something particularly pernicious about this, you know, preying on children.
I think I've seen other documentaries about Saville, and I think the thing that stirred me the most about of all the things he got up to was his free access to Broadmoor and the other hospitals, where his victims were completely helpless people who couldn't escape. And this was definitely known about. I mean, come on, you know, staff, management, from the top to the bottom, there were people who knew what was going on, and he was given unfettered access.
Well, I think, you know, this is one of the things, is he they don't really talk about you know, having any kind of a official contract here with Prince Charles. So... Mm. It seems to me what's going on is it's favours and favours. So when it comes to potential prosecutions of Jimmy Savile, he can pull in those favours. He's someone who's been advising Charles. You know, absolutely fascinating. And the idea that this guy is, you know, the heir to the throne now after spending many years, you know, strenuously protecting the biggest paedophile martyr this country's ever seen.
Yes, I'm aware of the linkages with the royal family. But as I come back, I mean, the Epstein case in the US, people think that this is just bad behaviour by powerful people. It isn't just that. There's an intelligence and aspect to this. And paedophilia is important because it remains an illegal taboo. If you go to prison as a paedophile, you're put on a special section of the prison because you get beaten up by the other prisoners. You threaten people with that, then they will do what you say.
Amazing.
We've got a photograph of you,
amazing,
for example, doing something with an underage child.
Epstein
you will be in trouble.
All Epstein's residences, there was cameras in each room running constantly. And one wonders whether maybe a similar thing with Saville, for example. What about, I mean, there was a fascinating fact in there about Lockerbie. So the idea is that Jimmy Saville is advising the royal family on how to deal with the Lockerbie attack.
Well, he's wormed his way into being, you know, the you can imagine the royal family are pretty isolated from ordinary folk, and they've projected onto Jimmy Savile, who went down a mine and all the rest of it, that he is the ordinary folk. And when he tells them, so he had an IQ of 180 something, very clever guy, Savile, very manipulative, and of course, you know, it doesn't show sign very well on him. Incidentally, of course, various plaques and statues of Saville have been removed. And of course,
he was made a sir, wasn't he?
Well, indeed, but I mean, the point is that, you know, people say that you shouldn't remove existing statuary, but Jimmy Savile's stuff was all removed
done a lot of work on Lockerbie over the years. One of the best things ever made on it was by Alan Frankovich, the Maltese Double Cross documentary,
indeed,
which was shown on Channel 4. But certainly my view, I don't know what you think, Martin, but this was a deliberate killing of US law enforcement people on their way back to expose CIA drug dealing and arms dealing in the Middle East, and particularly heroin dealing by the CIA, the sort of thing which was picked up in Oliver North in Iran-Contra. So, you know, that is, you know, if the US are killing their own law enforcement people to protect the CIA, or the CIO blowing this airliner up. It just seems incredible that somebody like Saville should be then steering the royal family and how to react to it.
Well, I mean, the royal family will be, you know, getting advice from Saville about how whether to turn up, what to say, and all the rest of it. The underlying thing about Lockerbie is, as you say, far more serious. And of course, it's very clear that Libya definitely didn't do it. And that was, and I think it was clear when McGrathy was released by the Scottish government, Alex Salmond was first minister at the time, because a police officer was going, a Scottish police officer was going to testify at the appeal that the CIA had planted the evidence on the crime scene of a bomb of a circuit board,
yeah,
which supposedly from Libya.
Yeah.
So in other words, that was a crime carried out by our own deep state, not by the Libyans. And of course, that is actually quite normal. People have got, there's actually a big history of Western intelligence services engaging in terroristic activity. And you can be quite sure, for example, that the Russian FSB are very well aware of all of these things.
Anyway, if anyone that's interested in the documentary, I'll put a link to it up on our show page. Full two parts. It's about, I think, 3 hours altogether. But isn't it interesting how it takes a US firm to make such an interesting documentary? And one of the things I pointed out on Richie Allen when I did his program yesterday is the chronology, because Savile died. Then it was there was an attempt to get the truth out about him once he was dead and he couldn't sue them for libel through Newsnight. The BBC then decided that they were going to actually have a Jimmy Savile special through Christmas, all about it, which was, you know, the idea was to, you know, instantly the establishment are there trying to protect him rather than actually to prosecute him. And it does make you wonder about justice in this country, which brings us neatly on to Julian Assange. It's the final of four parts we're going to listen to now of the Laura Smith interview, which was done 11 years ago in 2011. Stella, you're probably going to be off now. Mm. So is there anything before we hear from Julian? This is a 10-minute or so clip. What you make of the whole Julian Assange case? Because I like to bring it up as often as I possibly can, because it just seems to be such a monstrous injustice.
I find it tragic, absolutely tragic, that this man has hardly seen the light of day. Now, I know some people say, oh, yeah, well, you know, he shut himself away in the embassy, but he felt he had no choice. You know, he went to a country that, you know, wouldn't more or less offer him asylum on British soil. He didn't feel he had any choice about that. Having, you know, looked into it as much as everybody else has, I feel he was totally fitted up. The sexual accusations from Sweden were just a total fit up. It was awful. And the British have been complicit in keeping him under house arrest at that embassy, you know, preventing his family from seeing him. And now he is the biggest martyr. He is, I can't say a martyr because he's not dead yet, but he's like a martyr for journalism in our lifetimes, definitely.
Yeah, I'd say probably the most important political prisoner on the planet. Mm. But at one time, banned in Britain, a TV station, RT, Rush Today, did a terrific interview with him 11 years ago. We're going to hear the final part of that right now. Thanks very much for joining us, Stella.
Former colleagues accuse you of playing too dominant a role in WikiLeaks, and one of your former colleagues has opened a new whistleblowing site, OpenLeaks, which is seen widely as a response to your sort of personality-driven campaign. Do you fear that OpenLeaks will ultimately be an embarrassment to WikiLeaks?
Well, unfortunately, it is been an embarrassment to us for a very long time. It is not a site that is opened. You know, this is a circumstance where we have seen many opportunists jump on to try and find ways to criticise us. The individual that is meant to be behind OpenLeaks was suspended in August 25 last year. He has since gone on to write a book and sell $1 million worth of Hollywood film rights. There is no competing website open for that organisation. However, there are other organisations that have started up their own leak sites, and some of those are quite good. For example, in Kyrgyzstan, one of the Kyrgyzstani newspapers has started up leaks about Kyrgyzstan. For Bulgaria, there's Bivol, which has started up a good site that we worked with in relation to Bulgarian cables speaking about organised crime. In Egypt, when the Egyptian protesters penetrated the Amdawa, the Egyptian secret police, and pulled out the archives, they started up Andawa Leaks. So we are proud to have stimulated that movement. There are some 30 different sites starting up or in the process of of having started with regional focuses and so on. Now, it's not quite as easy as it seems to do what we do. So a lot of them will find problems and difficulties and security issues, and some have already disappeared. But my hope is that out of this collection of some 30 or 35 sites that have started up, a few of these will work it out and will continue. You know, we don't see these as competition. Rather, it is our role to try and promote these sites and try and work with them.
You recently took delivery of a batch of files from a Swiss banker, Rudolf Elmer. Are you going to go after the banking community?
Well, we've never said that we've taken delivery of a batch of files. I mean, there was a press conference where two CDs were handed to us. Mr. Elmer is now in a difficult circumstance. He returned to Switzerland and was immediately rearrested. And I'm not sure what his precise strategy was in this press conference. He had a whole legal team around him and advisors. Perhaps he wanted to draw attention to his plight before he was arrested. But we are now in a difficult situation, that if we release any Swiss banking information from anyone, it will be alleged, no doubt, that it comes from Mr. Elmer, who is, at the moment, unindicted, sitting in a Swiss prison. So, effectively, there is a sort of hostage situation for us in relation to him. Obviously, that's not a situation that we will tolerate and are trying to work around. But it's a difficult and grim situation for him, and he needs more attention.
An anonymous army of talented hackers has sprung up around WikiLeaks. Is it now a digital state?
Well, I'm not sure about digital state, but you know, there is a very, very interesting youth movement that has started to occur around the world in the past, really the past 6 months, and especially since the beginning of the year. And that has been largely in response to us. It's not only in response to us, there's a few other things that has caused it to trigger. But we went from a situation 1 year ago where internet-educated youth was essentially politically apathetic to a situation now where the coolest people amongst internet youth are the ones that are the most politically active. And I think that's an extremely important development, and likely and a development will continue. My friends from the 1968 generation say that they have not seen such a youth movement since 1968. And this one is different. It is a worldwide movement from Tunisia all the way to the United States. And so I think it's a very, very heartening thing. And it just needs to be shepherded in the right way so it doesn't lose its momentum.
RT encourages its viewers to question more. What do you think they should be questioning?
Well, from our point of view, they should understand that most media is awful. It all has an agenda. Every single media organisation has an agenda. Every single media organisation has a backer. And it's necessary to know what the agenda and the backer of the media organisation is in order to try and understand what is being presented. If we look at our work over the last 12 months, think about that. While we pulled on some over 60 media organisations to help us with that in terms of promoting the material and spreading the material, all that material comes from a period of time before February 2010. So all these stories that have come out actually happened in the world before 2010, but people didn't know about it. So what is it that we don't know about now? So there's an enormous sort of hidden world out there that we don't know about until much, much later on. But it exists there right now. In our release of diplomatic cables, we only released secret, classified, confidential material. We didn't have any top secret cables. The really embarrassing stuff, the really serious stuff, wasn't in our collection to release. But it is still out there. So what is it? People need to not be comfortable that what they receive from the media is all that is happening.
And finally, Julian, who do you consider to be your number one enemy?
Our number one enemy is ignorance. And I believe that is the number one enemy of everyone, is not understanding what is actually going on in the world. It's only when you start to understand that you can make effective decisions and effective plans. Now, the question is, who is promoting ignorance? Well, those organisations that try to keep things secret, and those organisations which distort true information to make it false or misrepresentative. In this latter category, it is bad media. It really is my opinion that the media in general are so bad, we would have to question whether the world wouldn't be better off without them altogether. There's some very, very fine journalists, and we work with many of them and some fine media organisations, but the vast majority are awful and are so distortive to how the world actually is that the result is we see wars and we see corrupt governments continue on. One of the hopeful things that I've discovered is that nearly every war that has started in the past 50 years has been a result of media lies. The media could have stopped it. If they had searched deep enough, if they hadn't reprinted government propaganda, they could have stopped it. But what does that mean? Well, that means basically populations don't like wars. And populations have to be fooled into wars. Populations don't willingly and with open eyes go into a war. So if we have a good media environment, then we'll also have a peaceful environment.
And social networking, what role do you think sites like Facebook and Twitter have played in the revolutions in the Middle East? How easy would you say it is to manipulate media like that?
There's many ways in which they can be manipulated, but first I have to take issue with your view that Facebook and Twitter were important for the Egyptian revolution. Now, we have people in Egypt. We were involved in the middle of the Egyptian uprising. The primary organisational groups in Egypt were the ultras. They were the soccer clubs in Egypt. And they produced a very important manual, the primary manual that was used on the streets, some 40 pages. On the first page it said, do not use Facebook on Twitter. And the last page it said, do not use Facebook on Twitter. And why did it say that? Because they have had past experience that when there were smaller demonstrations in Egypt that used Facebook and Twitter, everyone was rounded up by the intelligence services. So Facebook in particular is the most appalling spying machine that has ever been invented. Here we have the world's most comprehensive database about people, their relationships, their names, their addresses, their locations, their communications with each other, their relatives, all sitting within the United States, all accessible to US intelligence. Facebook, Google, Yahoo, all these major US organizations have built-in interfaces for US intelligence. It's not a matter of serving a subpoena. They have an interface that they have developed for US intelligence to use. Now, is it the case that Facebook is actually run by US intelligence? No, it's not like that. It's simply that US intelligence is able to bring to bear legal and political pressure to them, and it's costly for them to hand out records and one by one, so they have automated the process. Everyone should understand that they, when they add their friends to Facebook, they are doing free work for United States intelligence agencies in building this database for them. And every other intelligence agency that can either hack Facebook or who can do a favour with US intelligence.
Julian Assange, thank you very much.
So that's the final of four-part interview done by Laura Smith at RT 11 years ago in 2011 with the incarcerated now Julian Assange, one of the most important and impressive in publishers of the 21st century, sitting in Belmarsh prison as if he's a terrorist. Well, how disgusting is that? I'll leave that up to you. But Martin, I mean, he's talking there about, you know, the use of social media at the end there. I mean, I suppose actually 11 years ago was kind of almost like early days of Facebook. It hadn't been around for that long. It was MySpace before that, I seem to remember, was kind of social media, which then went out the window. And Twitter and Facebook are now, you know, where it's at. But he's making it clear that these organisations are absolutely in bed with the US intelligence, the Central Intelligence Agency and the NSA.
Yeah, well, I mean, we used to be worried about how, you know, people's minds were being moulded by corporate television, and then there was a kind of ideology that the internet and social media would create a much more open information space, and now, of course, social media has become a main means of manipulation by those same powers that be.
What are your thoughts on where it's heading, this Assange case? We're hearing that it may be some sort of... Ultimately, it's going to be Priti Patel's decision, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think the problem for them is it's become a bit of a... For the British authorities, it's become a bit of a... You know, they can't let him go because the Americans will go mad, but they're not quite sure how they can get him extradited under British law because he ain't done anything. So they're in a bit of a, and if they do, they're going to draw attention to him. I think this kind of holding pattern where he just stays in Belmarsh and keeps appealing, and nobody mentions the case in polite circles is the strategy.
Will it work?
Well, it means that he has to rot away in Belmarsh indefinitely. Which, of course, in a sense, and as long as people don't, most people are not really aware. I mean, obviously, politically active people are aware of it, but I mean, the number of MPs who've taken an interest in the case is a handful, all the usual suspects from the campaign group of the Labour Party, but nobody else wants to know. And I think that's extraordinary. You know, this is an absolute outrage to the English legal system. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I would argue that anybody who's got any background in law can see that this case is just a farrago and nonsense.
Well, it's also an affront to the civilised world, the idea that someone who's one of the most important publishers on the planet using the great new medium, the internet, rather than old-fashioned printing presses and things like that, is somehow incarcerated. I mean, it's medieval.
Well, I mean, what it does is it intimidates all of those who are out there who are thinking of doing similar things. And, of course, with the barrage of propaganda we're being subjected to now about the Ukraine war, you know, the sort of thing that Julian was doing about the war in Iraq, etc., becomes ever more to the point, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. Anyway, we're approaching Easter now, aren't we? So we're going to have a little bit of an Easter-y flavour at the beginning of our break. We'll be back to talk about Ukraine, particularly after the break.
My own reward. I really didn't come here on my own accord. Just Just need to know where the soldiers can find him.
With no crowd round him,
then we can't fail.
I don't want your blood money.
Oh, that doesn't matter, our expenses are good.
I don't need your blood money.
But you might as well take it, we think that you should.
Think of the things you can do with that money. Choose any charity, give to the poor. We've noted your motives, we've noted your feelings. This isn't blood money, it's a
fee.
A fee, nothing more.
Watch out for the skin.
That's from Jesus Christ Superstar, Damned for All Time, 1973, followed for a decade after that, The Stranglers and The Skin Deep, from 1984. Well, just over a decade, isn't it? So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And thanks ever so much to Bristol-based cancelled cartoonist Stella Perrett, who apparently we were chatting just as she was off going off about her latest cartoon, which is about Ukrainian refugees and the way that it's like a conveyor belt for women and children, and that Ukraine has been a notorious as a place for organised crime trafficking, particularly women and children, in the past. So fascinating stuff from Stella, and I'll put a link to her site and her latest cartoon, that one we were talking about there, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Her website is radicalcartoons.com, and her YouTube channel, Radical Cartoons, is where she talks about the people trafficking in Ukraine. So, Martin, obviously, starting with Ukraine, the biggest thing this week by far is the Butcher massacre, even with some wags in the press, you know, joking about this idea that, oh, the Russian butchers from Butcher.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's obviously in the Western media, this incident has been, the main story of the week. Obviously, on the ground in the Ukraine itself, the situation is rather different. But what looks to have happened, I mean, the Russian Ministry of Defense have already said about this, that we withdrew from this town as part of the peace negotiations, which are still ongoing. We withdrew from this town on March the 30th. The local mayor then gave a video selfie interview where he said, thank goodness the Russians have gone, the Ukrainians are back in control, it's all good news, everything's fine. And then the Azov battalion and the Ukrainian National Police said that they were going to go into the town and deal with saboteurs and traitors. Then suddenly all of these dead bodies appear. Well, there's only 20 or so on the actual videos, but they're claiming hundreds.
They're talking about mass graves,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, mass graves and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, the mayor of Bucha was giving a speech to the world on April the 1st, saying that saying everything was well and there was no problems at all. Now, of course, suddenly all of these bodies have appeared, and it looks to me as if what actually happened is that the radicals, because, of course, you've got loads of paramilitary units fighting for the Ukrainians, they're not an all-regular army, have gone in there and taken, you know, killed a load of locals who they think have been collaborating with the Russians, and then spun this into the world media as a Russian atrocity. And of course, they've been doing this for quite a long time. If you go back to the Maidan massacre at the beginning of the crisis in 2014, it was claimed that the Berkut riot police had shot down the pro-EU demonstrators, but a court case in Kiev in 2018 showed that in actual fact it was a death squad of people largely from Georgia, orchestrated by NATO, that killed those people. So the Ukrainian secret services, the SBU, for example, they also assassinated one of their negotiators with the Russians. He came back from the negotiation and he was shot dead by his own secret service. This stuff is just not reported in the West. The fact is that the Ukrainian regime is riddled with extreme right-wing people who are in cahoots with Western intelligence services to create war porn, to try and make the conflict continue. And there are negotiations going on, but the British in particular and our security services are involved in the creation of massacres. They're not just faking the massacres. People are being massacred, but they're being massacred by the Ukrainians. And I'll finish by saying this. If it turns out that it was in fact the Ukrainian SBU, the Azov battalion, who carried out this massacre in Bucha, will people stand trial in Ukraine? And will the British operatives who are working with them, will they stand trial? Because if we're going to say, we're going to accuse Putin of war crimes and all the rest of it, what if the war crime we're accusing him of, we committed?
What about some of these figures that were there was film of in Bucha, these dead people on the ground, seem to be carrying supplies of some sort, maybe like humanitarian aid, possibly from the Russians?
Indeed.
And that didn't seem to be explained in a lot of this.
No, and of course, many of them are wearing a white armband. Now, the reason why the Russian troops are all wearing a white armband so that they can recognise who is because of course in warfare, in modern warfare, where people are all wearing the same kit, you don't know who's who. And it looks as if the Azov battalion and other radicals have gone into this town, rounded up various locals that they thought were unreliable, and murdered them as part of their intimidation tactics. And then on the top of that, they've then said, oh, look, the Russians did this. But as the Russians pointed out, we left the town 4 days before the bodies were found. These bodies were all over the place.
Some say 2 days. But
yeah, but even so, the mayor of the town said on April the 1st that the Russians had gone and there was no mention of any bodies at all.
I think at this point we ought to mention Operation Gladio, because we do know that the NATO intelligence services, and it may quite potentially be that we've got NATO countries' special forces operating in Ukraine right this minute, potentially doing things like this. They like to boast about these sort of things afterwards, quietly, that the Operation Gladio from NATO in the past, which we've looked into extensively on this programme, Alan Frankovich, you mentioned earlier about the Lockerbie film, also made a three-part documentary, a brilliant documentary for the BBC back in the days when they used to do true journalism, investigative journalism, which was part of the Time Watch series. Where he explained that throughout the 1980s, particularly in Italy and elsewhere in Europe, NATO intelligence services had been employing fascist mercenaries and ex-soldiers, etc., to kill ordinary civilians in Europe in order to make political changes that would benefit the United States, Martin.
That's right. And, of course, the Ukrainians have always had a big role in Gladio. So lots of Ukrainian fascists were exfiltrated from the Ukraine at the end of the war. Many of them ended up in Canada. But they, you know, they're even talking now about having a stay-behind army in Ukraine to fight the Russians. So it's the same playbook as always. And NATO has got a track record going back decades of killing civilians.
Right. I mean, the cover for these Operation Gladio forces was this exactly what you're saying, the stay-behind force.
That's right.
The idea that you're going to have weapons caches with people with... for example, there was one, I seem to remember, one of the last articles I did for RT around about the time... I mean, this is a written article... around about the time that the Russians went into Syria, was about a weapons cache that had been discovered in Somerset, an absolutely amazing haul of all sorts of weapons from various different countries, which could potentially have been an IRA weapons cache, and it was found in one of the reens, one of the big drainage ditches under a bridge by some people who were magnet fishing. The idea being that if Britain was overrun by the Russians or whoever, that these irregular forces, often very right-wing forces, and ex-soldiers could use these weapons to cause all sorts of trouble behind enemy lines. But the point here I'm trying to make is that the originals for this, as far as we know, I mean, it may have been happened well before, but the SS had their werewolf forces at the end of the Second World War. So as the Allies and the Russians advanced towards Berlin, the werewolves would pop up. They were basically wearing civilian clothing, but then they would pop up behind enemy lines as the Russians and the Allies advanced towards Berlin and create sabotage operations behind them. So the actual origin of this Gladio force is in the Nazi SS at the end of the Second World War.
Well, that's right. And, of course, what happened was that instead of in the Russian-controlled zone, they did carry out... I mean, the Ukrainian... National Army or whatever they called themselves, they did operate inside the Ukraine. Stepan Bandera's people worked. He was exfiltrated, and loads of Ukrainian fascists escaped from Ukraine as the Russians came in. And Stepan Bandera, I was reading the other day, was actually assassinated by the KGB in Munich in 1959. And there was a long guerrilla war in the Ukraine between the Soviets and the Ukrainian nationalist partisans who had been fighting for Hitler. So what actually happened at the end of the war is the werewolf structures which Reinhard Galen had set up, which were just handed over to NATO. And Galen, who is the head of the Gestapo, ends up as the head of the West German intelligence.
It's amazing, services. These linkages, aren't they? And also, of course, the fact that the United States, through the Central Intelligence Agency, actively kept an active Nazi force in Ukraine in order to harry the Soviet Union.
That's right. And and of course, after 91, when the Soviet Union collapsed, these forces were all reactivated. And that they were behind the, you know, with Western intelligence services. So the Ukrainian fascist nationalist right would be dangerous in any circumstances, but they're particularly dangerous because they're being directed by MI6 CIA, who are, you know, fully fledged professional troublemakers.
Okay, so just looking at the latest on this, Ursula von der Leyen has been to visit Boucher, the president of the European Union. In the Straits Times, she says that the Boucher massacre in Ukraine shows the cruel face of the Russian army. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen, also known as the President of Europe, said the deaths of civilians in the Ukrainian town of Boucher showed the cruel face of Russian President Vladimir Putin's army, pledging to support Kiev in its defence of the border of Europe. During a visit to Butcher, where forensic investigators started to exhume bodies from a mass grave, Dr. von der Leyen looked visibly moved by what she saw in a town where Ukrainian officials say hundreds of civilians were killed by Russian forces. Russia denies targeting civilians in its more than six-week war against Ukraine and has called the allegations that Russian forces executed civilians in Butcher while they occupied the town a monstrous forgery aimed at denigrating the Russian army.
Well, that's what people would say. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? But if you think about it, the Russians withdrew from Bucha because of the negotiations they were involved in with the Ukrainian side. Negotiations, by the way, which were the Ukrainians denied for 8 years. For 8 years, they signed the Minsk Agreement and said that they would negotiate with the rebels in Ukraine, and then for 8 years they refused. And just before this military operation that the Russians mounted, they asked them for one last time, will you negotiate? And they said no. And now, of course, as soon as the fighting starts, they pick up the phone and say, well, actually, we can negotiate.
So who's going to carry out this forensic investigation? It's not going to be the Russians, is it?
No, it's not. And the BND, we mentioned them earlier, the German intelligence services, they claim to have telephone intercepts of the Russians, you know, agreeing to, you know, which
NATO have telephone intercepts.
Yeah, well,
they actually allowed anyone to hear them?
Well, indeed, and of course, the fact of the matter is that the BND, which used to be run by the former head of the Gestapo, Reinhard Galen, let's just remind ourselves of this. They were the ones who came up with that there was Novichok on the underpants of Navalny. Although it was a military laboratory which came up with this. What people have got to realise is that the Western intelligence services are liars. That's not to put too fine a point on it. You cannot trust anything they say. For example, just another example. For years and years and years, the US has been denying that they had biological weapons laboratories or biological laboratories which were investigating viruses. Then they admitted that they did. Now, in other words, so you've been telling us for years and years and years these things didn't exist, and now you've admitted that they did. Now, that is evidence that you are a liar, isn't it? You cannot take anything they say at face value. And there's actually an interview, I think, I can't remember where it was, in mainstream press in the US, where various people were saying, well, in actual fact, we've been making loads of stuff up about Ukraine, and they specifically mentioned the potential use of chemical weapons. And the reason we're doing this is because it helps the Ukrainians build their morale, and it's a useful way to stop the evil Russians. Now, they've actually admitted, in other words, that they make stuff up. Now, if once you go out there and admit that you're making stuff up, then you've got to say, well, hang on a minute, you're just making stuff up. And, of course, they've also got a track record of killing people in order to make stuff up. It's not just lies. Well, it's also murder.
The Church of England and the Catholic Church have been weighing in. This week we saw Rowan Williams saying that the Russian Orthodox Church should be, he's the former Archbishop of Canterbury, saying that the Russian Orthodox Church should be expelled from the World Council of Churches. Well, anyone that looks into Rowan will know he's actually also not only the Archbishop of Canterbury, but he's also an Archdruid. He was initiated into the Order of Druids quite publicly as well. So I had to laugh when I heard that. I mean, this is the original church that split from the Catholics back in 1154, I think it was, you know, with the split between the Orthodox and the Catholic Church and the siege of subsequent siege by the Templars of Constantinople, where Constantinople was sacked and there were rivers of blood, you know, carried out on the orders of Rome and the Templars. But anyway, that's a long, long time ago. So the idea that, you know, we're not having anything to do with the Orthodox Church just seems completely ridiculous coming from a Druid. So Pope Francis has also condemned Martin, the massacre of Bucha, and he's kissing a picture of him here in the Independent, kissing the Ukrainian flag. He's considering a trip to Kiev, and he's also criticised Russia's President Vladimir Putin.
Well, I find it extraordinary that all these people have already decided they know exactly what happened at Bucha. I mean, there hasn't been an investigation yet. And there's a very strong possibility that the Ukrainians are lying and that they are the guilty parties.
Well, one of the other things that occurs to me, and we were chatting just as Stella was leaving, she was talking about the forced separation of families in Ukraine that's been going on ever since this started. The idea that the women and children are going to go on a conveyor belt somewhere else and that the men have to pick up a gun and fight and potentially die for Zelensky. I mean, you know, there are all sorts of groups of men running around now in Ukraine who don't necessarily agree with Zelensky and they don't necessarily want to fight the Russians and die.
Well, there's also, they've been handing out weapons willy-nilly to, they've released all these prisoners from their high-security prisons and said, if you're prepared to fight the Russians, you can, here's your rifle, go and fight them. So what you've actually got is loads and loads of non-regular forces now who are armed.
Well, my understanding is it's a little bit more than that, actually, Martin, that these men have been told, you must fight. It's not that you're saying, here's a gun, would you like to come and join us? They're being told, no, you're not allowed to leave the area. You're now in the army, pick up the gun, and you're under orders. Well, here is your lieutenant.
Yeah, but what's actually happening in the East Ukraine, in Kharkov, for example, which is still under Ukrainian control, the mayor of Kharkov, who's pro-Kiev, is saying that he doesn't want people to leave the city because, you know, because that's running away. So people trying to run away are all in the West Ukraine. In the East Ukraine, where the Ukrainians are in control, they're preventing the civilian population from leaving so they can use them as human shields.
There also seems to be a definite attempt by the Ukrainian army to make sure that the battle zones, the fire zones, are in urban areas rather than in the countryside.
That's right, and it also turns out that the story about how the Russians bombed the theatre in Mariupol and and also the hospital all made up, and that lots of people who've come out of Mariupol are saying that in actual fact the Azov battalion in control of Mariupol were preventing civilians from leaving and shooting them at random to prevent them leaving, all of which is being reported honestly in the Russian media, where the support for the government's position is actually in the 83% now. You know, the idea that we're going to overthrow Putin by having sanctions on him is absurd, because the Russian, and of course the idea that Putin is the mastermind behind all of this is also wrong. The Russian state, which is actually quite a complex structure, have decided that they're going to draw a line in the sand here and they're going to fight. Don't forget, 13,000, 14,000 people have already been killed in this conflict, the vast majority of them civilians from the East Ukraine who speak Russian. And that's, and even with the killings that have been going on now in the latest phase of the war, they still outnumber the dead Ukrainians who speak Ukrainian or identify with Ukraine by several orders of magnitude.
Anyway, we're going to hear from the first of three experts on Ukraine now, neither Martin nor I. The first is Britain's number one expert, I suppose you would call her, Liz Truss, our Foreign Secretary, speaking a couple of days ago in Poland about how she will not run away from Vladimir Putin.
3 weeks ago, the UK led 41 states to refer these atrocities to the International Criminal Court. We're providing additional funding to the ICC. The UK military and police are providing technical assistance to the investigations, and the Metropolitan Police War Crimes Unit have commenced the collection of evidence. We're working very closely with the Ukrainian government on this. We've appointed former ICC judge Sir Howard Morrison as an independent advisor to the Ukrainian Prosecutor General. And today I can announce that we're launching a £10 million civil society fund to support organisations in Ukraine, including those helping the victims of conflict-related sexual violence. We will not rest until these criminals have been brought to justice. We are clear that after these appalling crimes, Russia has no place on the Human Rights Council. And it is the responsibility of the UK and our allies, and that's what Dmytro and I have discussed today, to step up our support for our brave Ukrainian friends. That means more weapons and more sanctions. Putin must lose in Ukraine.
So that's British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. We've got a couple more short clips with her, Martin. But she's quite right, isn't she? The United Nations has just voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. The measure passed with 93 votes in favour, 24 against, and 58 abstentions. The UN General Assembly yesterday voted to remove Russia from the Human Rights Council. Was put forward by US Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield. The measure passed with the votes that I said, and it makes Russia the first permanent member of the UN Security Council to ever have its membership stripped from a UN body.
Well, if you actually look at the votes and you toss it up, it shows that there are two camps developing in the world. And, you know, they've got the votes just about to remove Russia from this particular committee. But if you actually add up the people who voted against or abstained, that's the majority of humanity. So, I mean, in the rest of the world...
No, actually, it's 93 in favour, 24 against, and 58 abstentions. So yeah. There's more votes in favour than there are against and abstentions.
Yes, but if you count the Chinese and the Indians, one of whom voted against and one of whom abstained...
Oh, right, so the populations they represent. Yeah, okay.
That's right. I mean, the small countries get one vote just
sorry,
like everybody else.
I'm being a bit dim there, yeah. Sorry.
Well, also, of course, what happened on Tuesday this week was that as soon as this Bucha massacre thing came out, the Russians said, right, we want a Security Council meeting straight away because we're going to refute all of this. And normally, the normal procedure at the UN is if a permanent member of the Security Council calls for a meeting, there's supposed to be a meeting that very afternoon. They're not supposed to delay. It's about 3 hours. They have a meeting. But the British, who actually got the presidency of the UN Security Council at the moment, wouldn't let them have a meeting so that they could then carry on with their propaganda without
well,
the Russians
right.
being allowed
yeah,
to answer
it. Seems that that gives them an extra 24 hours of news coverage, rolling
that's
news
right.
coverage of headlines. And, of course, people will remember those headlines. They won't remember the fact that the British stopped the Russians actually having a say in those headlines, which would have happened if there'd been a UN Security Council meeting.
Yeah, well, I think what's going to happen, actually, is that this is a very botched false flag operation by the Ukrainians.
But it doesn't matter in a way, does it? Because the headlines are what stick with people.
It does, but of course what will happen is countries like China and India, who have their own intelligence services, will draw their own conclusions about what happened.
There have also been other videos circulating this week. I sent one around on my Telegram channel, Tony Gosling Censored. If you're on Telegram, you can pick it up there, which is pretty horrific. It's of Russian soldiers, prisoners being brought along in transit vans and then shot in the legs, and they're writhing on the ground. And you can see that they're being kicked by the Ukrainians, and then another load of Russian soldiers, and they're actually Ukrainian soldiers with rifles. Just actually, you can see them live. It's filmed them being shot in the legs. Obviously, these guys as they're getting out of the van.
And in the groin.
And they're getting it. Well, I didn't see that myself, but lying in pools of blood, being left to die, basically, after some of them with horrendous amounts of bleeding, and these soldiers just wandering around kicking them.
Yeah, well, as Zelensky said, because of the
terror... What's the purpose, for propaganda purposes, for the Ukrainians filming themselves doing this?
One of the problems the Ukrainian side has got is that they've got a culture of radical anti-Russian sentiment about the Azov Battalion and others similar.
And they're just sort of boasting.
Yeah, they're basically shooting selfies of them doing in Russian soldiers who have surrendered. But of course, that then rather undermines the propaganda that we're the good guys and they're the bad guys, doesn't it?
So I posted that up on my VK page. Now, this is the organisation that Edward Snowden joined when he went over to Russia. It's a sort of alternative to Facebook. And after I got my Facebook ban, which I think was most definitely related, as my previous Facebook ban was, to the last year's local elections here, I know our Mayor Marvin Rees pays Facebook for all sorts of things, and so Facebook are paying him back by banning me right the way through from the feeds of people, right the way through the mayoral referendum, the idea of having the mayor referendum campaign, which is a bit irritating. But the point being that VK is actually becoming quite a good place to get information. They don't censor it. You know, obviously, we've seen lots of horrific pictures on our TV screens of these massacres, especially late in the evenings here. You know, if you put something with the Russians on Facebook, you will just get it banned basically straight away if it's a pro-Russian thing. Anyway, let's listen to the second clip with Liz Truss now, where she talks about having to have now more sanctions. And of course, Martin, this is what this Bucha massacre is really about. It's about justifying bringing in more heavy weapons, you know, new equipment, maybe a no-fly zone. We've got to up the ante. We're not doing enough because the Russians are massacring people. Only thing is, maybe it's just the Azov Battalion Nazis massacring their own people that won't play ball with the Nazis.
Later this week, the G7 foreign ministers and the NATO foreign ministers will meet. We need to announce a tough new wave of sanctions. The reality is that money is still flowing from the West into Putin's war machine, and that has to stop. In Brussels, I will be working with our partners to go further, as has been advocated by Dmytro, in banning Russian ships from our ports, in cracking down on Russian banks, in going after new industries filling Putin's war chest, like gold, and agreeing a clear timetable to eliminate our imports of Russian oil, gas and coal. We also need even more weapons of the type the Ukrainians are asking for. The UK is supplying more, including next-generation light anti-tank weapons, Javelin missiles and Starstreak anti-aircraft systems. And last week, we hosted a donor conference with our allies to secure more. The fact is that being tough is the only approach that will work. Putin has escalated this war, and this approach is vital to ensuring he loses in Ukraine and that we see a full withdrawal of Russian troops and Ukraine's hand is strengthened at the negotiating table.
That's the British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss again, stumbling over a script a little bit, but she's also talking about stopping money going into the Putin war machine and announcing new sanctions.
Well, the Russians are pretty calm about this, because by what they're doing is they've rubleized their, they're saying to people, if you want to buy our stuff, you're going to have to buy in rubles if you're an unfriendly country, and the ruble has stabilized on the back of that. And because of the war itself, the price of oil and gas has gone up, and in actual fact, the Russian, can you believe this, the Russian budget is in surplus. We're not in surplus. The US isn't in surplus, the EU isn't in surplus, but both China and Russia have got a budget surplus, and it's actually increasing. And that's actually because of the sanctions. So
how does that work? Why do the sanctions help them do that?
Because the sanctions actually, ultimately, are a way of wrecking the European economy to help the Americans.
I noticed the Europeans, I mean, I just think that, you know, people like von der Leyen seem to be stabbing the Europe in the heart, you know, as they do things like this, because what she's doing is another thing, for example, banning all the imports of Russian coal. Well, this just makes the Americans rub their hands. Oh, gosh, you're going to need even more energy now, aren't you?
Yes, and I think that ultimately a lot of this is about making what was beginning to develop, which is perfectly logical, is a profound economic relationship between China, Russia, and Europe. You know, and of course, once that gets going, then where does that leave the United States?
Europe is the battleground, isn't it? With the US basically pulling one way, and they seem to be winning.
Well, it's quite clear that the EU elites and British elites, you know, there's no difference really, are driven by this US policy, which of course is ultimately also driven by Israeli policy. Interestingly, I sent you a thing this week about how the Israelis are getting off the fence now after this Bucha massacre, because they were trying to say, they were saying that we're not going to have sanctions on Russia, we can be mediators between Ukraine and Russia. And the Russians were kind of putting up with that. They have a reasonably constructive relationship with the Israelis. But because the Israelis have now said that they're going to go along with sanctions on Russia, Russian foreign ministry has started to call the Israelis out and say, well, actually, you're the ones in occupation of land that you shouldn't have. You're the ones who are killing civilians. And, of course, don't forget, they didn't mention this in the long statement that they made, don't forget that the Russian army is sitting just over your border. And if you start to make trouble for us, maybe we can go to war. Have a think about that.
From the start, he says, Joe Luria at Consortium News says, Martin, you're quite right. The article is Israel-Russia clash over Ukraine. From the start of Russia's invasion, Israel has refused to join the West's economic war against Moscow, maintaining a neutral stance, a possible power broker to end the conflict. But all that appears to have changed this week with remarks by Israel's foreign minister in a Twitter post the day the massacre at Bucha was revealed and before any investigation could be conducted. Foreign Minister Yair Lapid wrote, "It's impossible to remain indifferent to the face of horrific images from the city of Bucha near Kiev." I mean, how he knows that this was done by the Russians and not by the Nazis is really... Well, he doesn't. But he seems to think he does. Maybe he's got very good intelligence, Martin. Maybe even he knows exactly who did it. From after the Russian army left, intentionally harming a civilian population is a war crime, and I strongly condemn it. Israel's ambassador to Ukraine has also implied that Russia committed a war crime. Deeply shocked by the photos from Bucha, he said on Twitter, "Killing of civilians is a war crime." So the Israeli foreign ministry tried to distance himself from the ambassador's remarks. Haaretz reported he asked if the foreign ministry's official position was that Russia had committed war crimes. The spokesman replied, "No, it's a tweet by the ambassador." He didn't blame Russia, although he did. So Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who flew to Moscow on March the 5th to meet with Putin and was condemned for it, has made no comment about the Bucha incident. But years of goodwill have now been put on the line with Foreign Minister Lapid's remarks, and now Russia has struck back. Sergei Ivanov, head of the Department of Diplomacy and Consular Service at the Foreign Ministry's Diplomatic Academy, wrote a scathing critique of Israel on Wednesday, posted on the ministry's Telegram page. "It holds nothing back, openly condemning Israel for a variety of sins, including its treatment of the Palestinians," Martin.
Well, that's right. People think that this is a war in Ukraine, but of course it could easily become a war in Syria and a war between Russia and Israel in Syria. And one of the things that people haven't picked up on is that there is actually a massive Russian naval presence in the eastern Mediterranean.
Do you think the Russians are confident they could win a war on different fronts at the same time?
I think that they wouldn't have done what they've done if they didn't think they could. It's pretty obvious.
Well, is it? I mean, surely they've been overstretched. Maybe another way of interpreting it is that the Russians have fallen into a bit of a trap in Ukraine and they've overstretched themselves that maybe the West will win here.
Well, look, I'm obviously not party to the Russian Stavka general staff's thinking, but you don't start a war with the intention of losing it, do you? They must have made the calculation that they think they can win. And, of course, what's actually problematic for the West is that all of these sanctions that they're putting on is actually strengthening the Russian economy and undermining the European economy, which will, of course, if the European economy crashes, yeah, the euro goes down the drain and all the rest of it, that will crash the US banking system. But the Chinese banking system, which is owned by the government, is solvent. And both Russia and China are in budget surplus, so they've got plenty of ammo.
You could look at it that the Russians have taken on the same mafia that we have been fighting since the Thatcher era in the West.
Well, what we're dealing with here is the reaction in Russia itself to the Thatcherization of the economy in the 1990s, when we went over there and got it all privatized and into the hands of the oligarchs. And of course, when all of these sanctions against oligarchs and they're seizing their yachts and everything, people in Russia are cheering that. They hate the oligarchs. And the government, in fact, is not an oligarchic government. And so, therefore, all these oligarchs getting a hard time from the West is actually very popular in Russia. So it's doing nothing to undermine the Russian war effort.
Anyway, one thing that Liz Truss is quite right about, a final clip from her, is that the Russians started this by going into Ukraine.
There should be no talk of removing sanctions while Putin's troops are in Ukraine and the threat of Russian aggression looms over Europe. We need to see Putin withdraw his troops. We need to see Ukraine's full territorial integrity restored. We need to see Russians' ability for further aggression stopped. We need a plan to rebuild Ukraine, and we need justice done at the International Criminal Court. Dmytro, we salute your bravery and the bravery of the Ukrainian people. We are determined to help in whatever way we can. We will back you unwaveringly in your negotiations. And together, we will not rest until Putin fails and Ukraine prevails.
Liz Truss there, and a final clip from her, Martin. So she's also rubbing her hands at the prospect of rebuilding Ukraine. This sounds a bit like disaster capitalism.
Yes, well, I mean, in actual fact, Ukraine has been completely looted by Western intervention. The oligarchs in Ukraine are worse than the oligarchs in Russia. And, of course, Kolomoisky, who is... Kolomoisky is Zelensky's sugar daddy, and he also funded the Azov battalion. She's talking there about negotiations, and I feel like shouting from the rooftops. There haven't been any negotiations since 2014 until 2022, until the Russians intervened. At that point, the Ukrainians decided they could negotiate.
I mean, this Bush...
And then the British have been pushing the Ukrainians not to negotiate for 8 years. And now Liz Truss is saying negotiations. Perhaps if they'd negotiated before all this, there wouldn't be a war to talk now, about.
One of the problems for me with this Bucha massacre is that if it's not interrogated by the West, if it's just taken at face value as, oh, this must be the Russians that have done this, then this sort of thing can happen again. Not only that this can be used by the West, believing that they've bamboozled their population into thinking this, even though they haven't actually done a proper investigation at all. And in fact, they are on site, they are controlling that investigation, and they are, of course, not impartial. It cannot be an impartial investigation. That they then use this as an excuse to actually, for NATO to themselves to start intervening. Maybe not just with this one incident, but the idea seems to me to be build up the case for NATO to get in there, get stuck in.
Well, there's been talk of having no flies. I mean, Zelensky at one stage said we want any weaponry you've got, because we're going to fight to the last Ukrainian, and we want a no fly zone. But of course, what stopped a no fly zone is because an attempt to put in a no fly zone over Ukraine would lead to NATO's aircrafts being wiped out. There is no way they could force it. They
would mean
they could
things
put
like
a no fly zone over Syria. For
so,
the same
for example,
reason.
It would mean the bombing by the Russians of Polish airfields where those aircraft were coming
Absolutely.
From. For example,
and of course, they may decide with their missiles, the hypersonic missiles they've got, they might decide to hit Fairford. Why not? If they're flying from Fairford, the B-52s are flying from Fairford, you're trying to put in a no-fly zone over what we regard as our territory in the Ukraine, and therefore we're going to put a missile into Fairford.
You probably hear bang. That. You probably hear that from Bristol. So if you hear an enormous great bang from the northeast, then you know what it is, and you feel the ground shake. Anyway, another expert, our expert number two, has been exclusively on this show before, but here he is talking on a podcast, which is The First Casualty of War is Truth, not that original. But anyway, he is certainly one of the best analysts. That's why he's been banned from Twitter this week. Scott Ritter.
There's an awful lot of people out there today who, you know, talk about Putin's playbook, the Russian playbook, as if they have a copy of it right next to them and they can flip over to page 63 and tell me exactly what's transpiring. Nobody has a copy of it except Putin and the Russian general staff, and they're not sharing it. To the extent that they do provide insight, we would do well to listen to them. For instance, in Putin's lengthy address justifying his decision to launch this special military operation, he was quite clear that this was done for the sole purpose of freeing Donbass, Luhansk, Donetsk from Ukrainian occupation to to return the totality of the territories of these two newly independent entities to their sovereign governments. But he said, you know, if we limited it simply to this operation, there's a huge mass of Ukrainian troops that Russia believed was getting ready to attack the Donbas, and that if you didn't take them into account, then this battle will become very complicated very quickly. And you can't take them into account simply by attacking them, but you also have to understand that they are connected to the Ukrainian military as a whole. So if you limit your attack to just addressing the 60 to 100,000 Ukrainian troops that are amassed in the Donbas region, you allow the Ukrainians now operating on interior lines. That's a nice little military term, meaning that they're using their own railroads, their own roads, their own logistics system. They have their ammunition dumps already in place. And so logistically operating is very easy. And logistics is sort of the heartbeat of modern combat. If your logistics is functioning and you have well-trained troops, you're going to do pretty good in this war. And so if you just leave the Ukrainians alone, they're going to be able to bring in reinforcements. They're going to be able to bring in logistics sustainability. And they're going to disrupt your entire operation up to and including they may win because they have a larger military in the immediate vicinity than the Russians have brought to bear. So Russia had to expand the operation to nullify this Ukrainian advantage. And this, I guess, would be what's called phase one. Now, to be fair to the critics of the Russians, and you know, Russia didn't come out and say phase one from the start. The Russians have not had a very good track record of explaining this war. Again, from a military perspective, they don't need to. You and I really don't need to know what's going on. The Russians don't care. But when your opponent is engaged in a massive information warfare operation that is done in concert with you know, NATO members, with mainstream media, et cetera, in a very virulent social media presence, you will be on your back foot diplomatically and from public relations standpoint by ceding the information battlefield to the enemy. And the Russians pretty much have done that. So they launched an operation. It wasn't explained at all what was going on. Why did they put an airborne assault into, you know, Hostomel Field on day one? What was the purpose of that assault? What was the purpose of coming into Kyiv? Were you trying to take Kyiv? Were you trying to isolate Kyiv? What, you know, or were you creating a diversion? They didn't explain everything. They're leaving it up to speculation. Now we come to phase two, and apparently the Russians have said, no, what we were doing was shaping the battlefield, which from a military standpoint is absolutely what you needed to do. They needed to shape the battlefield to divert Ukrainian resources, to pin them in place, freeze them, to make sure reserves didn't go down to the east but went north, to destroy the logistics infrastructure that could sustain combat. And it appears that Russia did all of this. But we're only finding out about it after the fact. Mm-hmm. And some people are saying, well, that's just Russia redefining their objectives because they got beat so badly in phase one. And that's one of the narratives that's out there, that Russia has suffered if not a strategic defeat, at least an operational defeat, compelling them to redefine their operation. But the operation that they're redefining sounds an awful like what President Putin said was their original objective. They are in the process of diverting significant combat power away from Kyiv, bringing it down to the Kharkov region, where they can launch an attack south from Kharkov. And they are taking the 40,000 troops that had been investing Mariupol and bringing them, and they're going to drive north. And at some point in time on the territory of Ukraine, eastern Ukraine, that northern pincer and that southern pincer are going to meet, and they're going to have surrounded 60 to 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers who will be rapidly eliminated as an effective combat fighting force. And that's going to be one of the great military victories of all time if it occurs the way than it appears to be occurring. Mm-hmm. Which then, again, now we come back to the information battlefield. Mm-hmm. When you're losing, when ground truth on the field of battle does not, isn't reflected in your favor, what do you do if you're the side that's losing? You seek to divert attention away from the defeat that you're getting ready to suffer, and you create alternative narratives. And I think this weekend we saw one of those alternative narratives.
So that's Scott Ritter referring to the Butcher Massacre as the alternative narrative. So the idea is that this is, he talks there about shaping the information battlefield, something that the West is extremely good at. The Russians are amateurs.
Well, I think, the Russians also have got a problem, which is that it's very hard to deal with people who are prepared to kill and to use lies in the way that the other side do. I think the way that, if you look at the way the Russian Ministry of Defense is operating, they give a daily roundup of what's going on, and it's very, very basic. What they're trying to do, and I think this is probably correct, is we'll leave the silly stuff to you. We are going to tell you what we know is going on, and what we say, we can back up. So we're not going to there's loads of things we're not going to tell you, but when we do tell you stuff, it's reliable stuff, which is pretty much the strategy pursued by the British in World War II. The other side come out with all this ridiculous propaganda. We just keep, we don't say very much, but what we do say is accurate.
We keep chugging along, but there are still apparently five major battles going on in Mariupol, down in the south, Uledara or something, near Donetsk, which is a bit north of there. Another battle going on in Luhansk, where the Russians are slowly but surely pushing the Ukrainian army out of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, pushing them out. And another battle going on at Severodonetsk, which is just north of there in an area which is not one of the breakaway republics but is now almost completely controlled by the Russians. Plus in Kharkiv, Martin, big fights going on still.
Yeah, well, most people in the West are blissfully unaware that the main fighting is actually in the East Ukraine, because they've been told that it's the Russians are invading Kiev. Now, of course, the Russians did that, as Scott Ritter, Scott Ritter, of course, former lieutenant colonel in the US Marines, is in fact somebody who knows something about military strategy.
Well, he's also an intelligence officer, so yes. he is the guy who will be advising on all these sorts of information warfare, etc. matters, and also about what is known about what the enemy are up to. So it's great to get him. Anyway, a bit more from Scott now, where he talks about what he calls. In fact, last week we heard from Mark Sloboda, if you remember, talking about what he calls the Great Decoupling. He's an ex-US military now teaching at Moscow State University International Relations. And he's saying that this is basically a chasm is opening up. Maybe before we hear from Scott, what you make of this, Martin, the idea of a chasm opening up between Russia and the West and Europe.
Well, it's not just Russia. It's Russia and China and India are starting to develop an alternative to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the Western financial system.
And Pakistan, by that's the way, there was
Pakistan
an attempt
and India on the same
there was
page.
An attempt to oust the Prime Minister in Pakistan last
that's
weekend.
Right,
and it failed.
Yes, and was also, according to the Pakistani ISI, there was also an attempt to assassinate Imran Khan. Now, in other words, this battle in the Ukraine is only one front in a global war. And, of course, what will ultimately happen is the collapse of the Western banking system with all of the consequences for the populations who are dependent on
it. It wasn't reported here at all as a coup, was it? And, various analysts, American political analysts, says the US coup failure against the government of Pakistan last weekend is a sign that the empire's days are over. For the first time in the history of Pakistan's parliament, its members chanted death to America as they rejected a no-confidence vote which sought to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan, saying foreign powers are interfering in the country's democratic process. National Assembly Deputy Speaker dismissed the no-trust move against the Prime Minister on Sunday, terming it as a contradictory to Article 5 of Pakistan's constitution. They are trying to pin it on the United States, Martin, and US interests in Pakistan. And an amazing picture of these Pakistani MPs chanting death to America as they reject Khan's no-confidence motion.
I think there's going to be a snap election. I think that's the way they're going to deal with that. What was interesting is Imran Khan also complimented Narendra Modi for refusing to go along with sanctions on Russia. Now, this is very significant. The Chinese voted against the removal of the Russians from the UN Human Rights Council, but the Indians abstained. Now, people might say that Modi is not really a Democrat, blah, 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 but the pressure on Modi, don't forget Modi was very close to the United States, and if Modi was to fall, you'd have a Congress government or possibly a communist element within it, and they are even more pro-Russian than Modi.
I think, look, just before...
So in actual fact, outside the Western bubble... people are not siding with Ukraine.
No, they're certainly not. I mean, let's go a bit further, because in this excellent article on Press TV website about the Pakistan coup attempt, this is an analyst in US speaking, journalist Don DeBar. He said the foreign power, that is the United States, hasn't been doing too well lately. New York-based journalist Don DeBar added, you can call it empire collapse. They're 0-3 in the past year alone, and their efforts in the past few years haven't been a tremendous success either. He said last year they failed in Belarus, they failed in Kazakhstan, they also failed in Honduras. The 2009 coup was undone in the election earlier this year, and their attempted coup in the legislature also failed, said DeBar. He also provided some additional examples. He said they're even seeing rebellion within the European Union. Even though they have Brussels in their pocket, Hungary is dissenting, and Poland is having doubts, although they're allowing the Maidan coup government to use Warsaw as their version of Vichy, which was the capital of France during the Nazi occupation during World War II. The attempted coup in Cuba failed before that, and the attempted coup in Nicaragua failed. They weren't able to capture Ecuador by buying off the designated successor to Correa, and that has also become a dead end. I mean, he's basically talking about a massive list now of failures of the CIA. The coup d'etat in Bolivia was very short-lived. Lula is now poised to win the next election in Brazil, and Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, former president of Argentina, has returned to power in the 2019 election, this time as vice president. So, you know, there seems to be a potentially, everything's going wrong. However devious and how much money they've got, and dastardly the CIA are, Martin, it's not working for them anymore.
No, it isn't. I think the real problem for us sitting here in Bristol is that Europe is going to be... there's going to be a massive crisis in the European economy as a result of all of this. The Russians will be all right, because in actual fact, sanctions in 2014, after the initial beginning of the crisis, allowed the Russians to start preparing for, you know, managing their own affairs without depending on the West. And don't forget, they've got every kind of raw material you could possibly imagine, and very technically skilled people. And they're friends with the Chinese, which are basically the biggest and most advanced economy in the world is becoming. And the Western Europe and Eastern Europe, you know, Europe in general, is in a very desperate position now, because without cheap energy from Russia and markets in China, German industry is finished.
Well,
so the Wirtschaftswunder after World War II is about to be unraveled. And but the German middle class are used to having a very comfortable lifestyle, and they're going to be a bit shocked to find out
that they're going to be out on their ear. Because usually the mafia operate, well, you better do as we say, otherwise you're going to lose your income or whatever. But it looks as if you're going to lose your income anyway. So what's the point of doing as the Americans say?
Well, what will happen, I think, is that although at the moment there's a widespread public opinion supporting the general policy being pursued, that the Ukrainians are brave little hobbits fighting the terrible orcs, and as Europeans we've all got to do our best to help them. But when you turn around to people, right, that means you're going to have to lose your job and your pension and your house. That's the price of your solidarity with Ukraine.
I mean, when I did an interview with Scott a few weeks ago, he said something rather wonderful, which I'll never forget, which was, with all due respect to Europeans, you're pathetic.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Russians for quite a long time have been trying, don't forget the Minsk agreement was between Russia, two Ukrainian sides, because it was an internal conflict, and that's how the Russians regarded it. They could have said straight away that we're going to recognise their independence, but he said, no, you've got to negotiate with Kiev, Kiev's got to negotiate. And they brought in Germany, France and Russia as guarantors of the agreement. They kept the British and the Americans particularly out of it for that very reason. And what the Russians have been trying to do is say to the Europeans, look, we can do business together. Get rid of the Anglos and, you know, we can get something fixed up for ourselves.
Anyway, it didn't work, did it? Anyway, let's hear now for a second piece, final piece from Scott Ritter, which is looking at this whole idea I mentioned earlier that Mark Sloboda came up with, I thought was excellent, and on the top of his Twitter feed, you'll still find it sitting there, what he calls the great decoupling between Russia and the West.
The Russian decoupling from the West. Mm. The West made a fatal mistake in declaring economic war on Russia. See, the West had far more control over Russian what happened in Russia if they had just left the Russian economy entwined, intertangled with the West, with all these Western companies there, with all the Russians invested in the West, et cetera. With the oligarchs, I mean, the biggest nightmare for Putin are the oligarch, is the oligarch class. What to do with them? So rich, they're so powerful, and their wealth comes from the relationships they have with the West. And what has the West done? They've neutered the oligarchs. The oligarchs have no more power. They lost all their money, and therefore they lost any political influence they have. So Putin doesn't care about them. He gave a speech the other day. He said, go, leave, get out of here. We don't want you anymore. Go to your wealth. We're done with you. Wow, that's liberating Putin there politically. And they disenfranchised an important segment of the Russian electorate, some 20%, who were middle-class voters who were married to the West. Now, had Putin tried to divorce them, there would have been a political backlash.
Yeah.
Because the West did the divorce, Putin's hand-free, and you see it, 83% support.
Yeah.
83%. He was 68% when the war started. He's 83% now, and it's going to climb because – the lesson of sanctions is the more you sanction, the more popular the leader becomes because the less popular the people who are doing the sanctioning are. So that has to be taken into account. This grand pivot east, the new relationship with China, the end of the rules-based world order that the United States has been promulgating, the birth of a law-based international order that China and Russia are pushing. And also now as we watch the European economy tank, guess who's going to start flourishing? Not just Russia and China, but what they call the Eurasian Economic Union. We're going to see a huge geopolitical gravitation as the economic center of the world leaves London, leaves France, leaves Germany, and starts moving its way over eastward. Because Russia and China, together with the Eurasian nations, India, they're done with the West. They're done. The West exists and you'll do. But the day that the day of the United States using the dollar to dominate the world is finished. It's over. The U.S. overplayed its hand. It's one of the great strategic mistakes of all time. And this is also going to play into effect. So Ukraine isn't just what's happening in Ukraine. Ukraine is what's happening in Europe and what's happening in the world, what's happening in Russia. And that's why I say anybody who thinks that Russia is simply going to stop this operation and negotiate itself into defeat, into a position of weakness, doesn't understand the big picture. Because this is so much more than just Ukraine. This is about the future of European security. If Russia surrenders in the negotiating table, they have no leverage when they talk about the future of European security. If Russia surrenders in the negotiating table, Putin loses all the political advantages gained by having the West orchestrate this defeat, this divorce. And if he surrenders on the negotiating table, the great transition to a trans-Eurasian economic future of multipolarity is over. So I don't see the Russians negotiating anything away. I see them basically, they're going to confront Zelensky with an awful reality, and Zelensky's going to have to decide how he's going to deal with that reality. It may cost Zelensky his life.
So what do you make of that, Martin? Fascinating, I think. Also looking at the idea that actually what's happened is our leadership, in their anger, in their 2 minutes hate against Putin, have sold us out, actually. They've sold us out, and they've handed over the keys, the Midas touch keys of the world, over to the East now, and London and Wall Street are basically history.
Well, I mean, they can still cause an awful lot of damage, so we shouldn't kid ourselves about how dangerous they are. But of course, that's
a push. You think for they actually want a war with Russia?
They want a continuous the U.S. deep state wants a continuous confrontation with Russia. So of course, in the short run, the military industry in the U.S. is...
they don't really care how many Ukrainians.
No, they don't. There's absolutely they wouldn't have carried out the coup in 2014 in the first place if they cared about the Ukrainians. All of this crocodile tears for the poor people of Ukraine is absurd because, of course, we now know from the Hunter Biden laptop that, in actual fact, the Biden family were making money out of looting the Ukraine and also were directly involved in the creation of these biological warfare labs, which has been forgotten about. And no doubt we're going to come on to discuss COVID in a minute. But, of course, one of the things that may have driven the Russians to do this is because they know, as the Chinese know, that COVID is, in fact, a biological warfare agent, and that's underlying all of this. This is World War III.
Anyway, our third expert is a little bit calmer than those others. His name is Sergei Lavrov, and I thought it'd be useful, the Russian foreign minister, to have him on, particularly because his daughter has now been sanctioned in London by the wise owls of the Western oligarchy here, but that is to say the British government. The idea of, Martin, this is bizarre, isn't it? Sanctioning members of people's family. You know, Sergei Lavrov's daughter has not played any role in this whatsoever, and yet now apparently her bank accounts in London have been frozen.
Well, the obvious thing to point out about...
She's studying, I think, somewhere in London.
The obvious thing to point out about this is if you start sanctioning individuals of people's families, like Lavrov's family or whatever, is that you've got no intention of negotiating whatsoever. So the Russian side can draw the conclusion, just as the Iranians did years ago, you're not really interested in talking about nuclear weapons, are you? You're not really interested in talking about negotiating in Ukraine. Right, in that case, you want regime change. Well, in that case, we're not going to talk to you about anything. We're just going to do what we're going to do, and if you want to try,
It might seem like an innocuous act, mightn't it, to sanction, say, Putin's daughter or Lavrov's daughter, cut off their bank accounts, that sort of thing, stop money getting to them. But actually, there's much more to it, as you just said. So let's have a listen to Sergei Lavrov. And an interesting question was asked to him a few weeks ago on RT when he did a simple interview for about 40 minutes with them about what he thinks the future of Ukraine and Russia is. These two countries, can they ever get along again together?
We never had any issue with the Ukrainian people. I have many Ukrainian friends. The two peoples are very close culturally. Practically all of them speak, and those who don't, they understand the Russian language, culture, common history, way of life, attitude to life, traditions of families and communities. So I hope that when this anomaly is over, this will gradually come back. It will have to be gradual. It cannot come back fast, because the efforts of our Western colleagues to make Ukraine a Russophobic and anti-Russian instrument, anti-Russia, as Putin called it, they started long ago. And they are already rather deeply rooted in Ukrainian mentality, especially the young generation, which was born after the demise of the Soviet Union. They have been indoctrinated in a very, very heavy way. And then the efforts were taken systemically to train military officers on the basis of radical Bandera and Shukhevich style methodology. The purpose being to make sure that they would not become friendly to Russia again, and that they would build their nationalism, nationalistic feelings, as the means to strengthen the statehood of their country. But this purpose, the purpose was always to make sure that Russia does not have Ukraine as a friend. It's like Zbigniew Brzezinski in the late 90s, last century, he said, Russia with Ukraine with a friendly Ukraine next to it, is a superpower. Russia with Ukraine, which is not friendly to Russia, is just a regional player. So this concept is very deeply rooted in the minds of American policymakers. So it will take time to get rid of those negative legacies. Even now, when the armed forces of Ukraine are fighting, trying to procrastinate the crisis. This is happening because the leaders of Ukraine, with the help of American and other Western advisors, reformed the army the way which put these radicals, Bandera-like trained officers, to lead more or less meaningful units in the Ukrainian army. And these people radicalize and terrorize others, especially those who don't believe that this should be the fate of their country. And the way they behave in the cities in Mariupol, the refugees who are coming from Mariupol to Russia in dozens of thousands, they tell their stories. It's really threatening how this kind of people command armed men and women. But I am sure, at the end of the day, the historic closeness of two fraternal nations will certainly prevail.
Ultimately, everybody's got to live with their neighbours. The Irish have got to live with the British, and the British have got to live with the Irish, and the Ukrainians have got to live with the Russians, and the Russians have got to live with the Ukrainians. The Syrians have all got to live together. They don't necessarily have to live with the state of Israel, because that state could end up being a victim of World War III.
The Senate in the United States has also voted to revive Lendlease for Ukraine. Antiwar.com is saying the Congress is voting to downgrade Russian trade status, ban Russian oil. And so, you know, quite obviously the idea is, look, let's just pour the money into Zelensky. It seems to me that the idea from the NATO country's point of view is if we just keep pouring more and more and more weapons into Ukraine, we can make this go on forever.
Yes, I think that is their calculation. And of course, don't forget that a lot of this stuff isn't actually gifts either. It's going to be put on account, like Lend-Lease was for Britain in World War II, and we had to pay for it all in the end. Churchill was appalled, but there you go. The Americans don't actually give you free stuff. They'll give you stuff, but they want the money for it at the end of it. I think the problem for them is that there's no way to get these weapons in. The Russians have total air control over Ukraine, and any attempt to bring weaponry in will be met with main force.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because I think maybe the special forces, etc., are going to be able to do that. The NATO special forces.
No, but all they can bring
in is small. Not very easy.
All they can bring in is small stuff. And you can't. I don't think the Russians have any intention of occupying the parts of the Ukraine where there's huge hostilities.
Well, they're keeping an eye with their satellites and their drones.
Right.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of use of drones, don't there, in this? Anyway, Martin, we're going to finish on anything more you want to say on Ukraine? I think we've pretty much
covered
done it to death there, haven't we? I think over the last week, particularly with this Bucha massacre and what was really behind that, we shall find out. And I did a debate on Press TV earlier this week with someone who was very convinced it was the Russians, and it was actually brilliant just to have the opportunity to have a proper debate about it. We don't get any of that on the Western press, which is maybe why RT and Press TV are banned in the UK. Martin, we're going to finish with the story about Shanghai and China's lockdown is brutal, apparently. Dystopian scenes of robots enforcing lockdown emerge from China. The Shanghai lockdown, some parents allowed to stay with COVID-positive children after backlash, splitting families up if someone is positive. Now, this is the Chinese population are starting to rebel against their government over this. This is not what China needs, surely. And the only country in the world that's going for this still, 2 years on, trying to pretend there's no such thing as COVID. And when it spreads around, they say, oh, we've got to stop it. Even though, of course, what they're dealing with is a much milder than the original form of COVID that is highly unlikely to actually kill people.
Well, you said there that people are rebelling against their government. I don't think there's any evidence of
that.
Oh, yes,
there certainly is. There's been protests in Shanghai, yes. Okay. I mean, if you're not seeing you haven't seen footage of it, I'll put some up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Street protests by the Chinese population against their government. Now, this is not surely what the Chinese government really need right now. In fact, funnily enough, they announced that they weren't going to do a lockdown in Shanghai. And then I think about a day later, this is maybe weekend before last, the Chinese government switched, changed their mind and went back to doing the lockdown. So it almost looks as if they had a flash of sanity. No, we don't need to do this anymore. This is a much milder version of COVID. And then they flip back into their original policy again.
All right. Well, we could go down the whole wormhole of COVID and lockdowns, but
the idea is the wisdom of whether you want to lock down when you're dealing with Omicron, which is a much milder variant than the original.
All right. Well, the evidence is piling up, Tony, that if you read the Larry Romanoff thing that I sent you, is that various waves of COVID have been simultaneously operating over the whole planet. You were on Press TV, the head of the Iranian Revolution.
We're talking about now, or
no? We're talking about COVID in general.
I'm just trying to talk about this thing that's going on now in Shanghai, which is 25 million people, families being separated from kids that are testing positive for something that's not even going to hurt them.
What the Russians and the Chinese believe is that COVID is a biological warfare attack on humanity. That's what they believe.
So they've decided to declare war on their own families, have they, as a result?
They are pursuing a policy of maximum mobilisation for World War III, Tony.
And that includes splitting up families.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Even though nothing is going to happen to the child that catches COVID at all.
Okay. They don't believe that it's just a flu that came from bats.
Well, it's not surprising the Chinese people are up in arms about it.
No, they're not.
I mean,
up
they
in
don't
arms,
want
Tony.
This. They are.
No, Tony.
I'm not saying 25 million are, because most people are extremely afraid of their own government in China. Probably less so than they are here, because there's more freedom here than there is in China generally, and it's less an authoritarian. But you have to admit that there have been protests, and that, in fact, in some cases, as that story I just read out says there. Some parents are now been allowed to stay with their COVID positive children because of the protests.
All right, the Chinese have pursued, as you know, a zero COVID policy from the very get-go of this crisis. In actual fact, that worked quite well for quite a long time, but obviously you're only as good as your last game in this game. I think the discovery of the biological warfare labs in the Ukraine is actually, and the Chinese and the Indians have both said to the Russian, to the US, what's going on in these labs? I think the evidence is becoming overwhelming that COVID was a deliberate attack on the Chinese, and they've responded with a warlike stance, because this is war. That's all I'll say.
Okay, well, anyway, thanks very much, Martin Summers. We're going to hear now our final clip. Martin can depart, strut off the stage, because we're going to be hearing, and in the run-up to Easter, this is from something called Alpha and Omega Productions, and he's saying they don't even bother keeping it a secret anymore. The cards are on the table for the New World Order agenda. And here is the guy, whoever he is, I have no idea his name, at Alpha and Omega Productions, talking about the transhumanists, the idea that actually what they're trying to do is a biblical thing, which is the idea of iron and clay. They will not mix, just like human beings and electronics will not mix.
The internet is becoming now, of course, all pervasive, isn't it? Everywhere. The transhuman stage. That smartphone isn't needed anymore. That it's all in here. This has all been downloaded to the cloud, downloaded to that great brain of computerization, completed. That man and computer then become one. The singularity, the mixing of iron and clay, as the scripture speaks about in Daniel. This is how Satan makes gods in his image. We're not going to be made in the image of God if we're following transhumanism. We're going to be made into Satan's image. The mixture of iron and clay, this is what they want. The ultimate connection between the two. And imagine having your brain downloaded to some internet server or internet memory bank or whatever it's called, so that you're then the fount of all knowledge. And of course, this was seen back in Genesis, wasn't it? We can't let man build that tower, and we can't let them get to that stage, because what does scripture say in Genesis? There'll be nothing impossible for them to not achieve. And of course, this is the stated goal of the World Economic Forum. It's the stated goal of many billionaires. There are many thoughts about Mr. Musk. The transhuman agenda, the idea of merging biology and technology. And of course, the technocrats, this is what they're planning in their smart cities and their smart workplaces. Of course, everything becomes smart, doesn't it? The Internet of Things. Everything tracked, everything traced, everything monitored, everything presented to this new God, the God of the cloud. Not the God that's coming in the clouds, but the God of the cloud. And this attempt is going to be basically an attempt to merge man and machine. And of course, referring back again to this, another technocratic invention, biology mixed with technology. The transhuman agenda, the bionic man. Of course, we've seen it in the films, haven't we? Mr. Schwarzenegger and his bionic powers. And I've spoken before about wokeness, the whole idea of social justice, and the way that these lies are being spilt out. The idea that if you have a certain color skin, then you're a hater of people that have a different color skin. The dissemination of hate. The idea that, in a false concept, that people of this color have only been haters of people of other color. An absolute lie. And of course, it's disseminated into politics. It's disseminated everywhere. And now, of course, the woke movement is now spreading this concept. So I'm gonna finish off with just saying here that this merger of idea, this merger of thought is all preparing itself for the coming of those two men, the false prophet and the Antichrist. Wherever there's a truth, there's a lie. Wherever there's something real, there's something counterfeit. And the two are drawing very close together now. And it's going to be more and more difficult to discern between the two. But there is a preparation. That preparation is taking place now. The spirit of Antichrist is in the world. As it says in John, there have been many Antichrists and there have been many false prophets. But we're beginning to see now that we're coming to a stage where that trinity of evil is going to rise its head. The beast, the Antichrist, the second beast, the false prophet, all powered by the dragon, Satan. And they've been shaping our world, especially over the last 2 years. And I just pray that we can all be alert to what's going on, because things are changing so rapidly, so quickly. We need that discernment from the Lord more than ever. We need to walk closely with him.
So that's Alpha and Omega Productions. Not sure what the guy's name is, but anyway, he calls this, they don't even bother keeping it a secret anymore. The cards are on the table. This is the New World Order agenda. Own nothing, be happy, maybe. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to Bristol-based cancelled cartoonist. Very good she is too. Extremely good. Almost up there with, some of the best, journalists, we cartoonists in the country. That's Stella Perrett. And also to sound engineer Dave Bazenko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you will also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email address. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling, and also shadow banned on Facebook too for the duration of our mayor referendum campaign, which is coming up in a month's time. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Also, thanks to RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, who do the restreaming for us. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 6, I think it will be, next Friday. Looks like our time has changed now. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow to run where the brave dare not go. To right the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star. No matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. And the world will be better for this, that one man scorned and covered with scars still strove with his last ounce of courage to fight the unbeatable foe, to reach the unreachable star.